It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running with another brand new program. This for the 13th day of June 2019. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. And that, of course, is also where you find access to the Merry Madcap Wacky Zany real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the chat room during the 3 hours in which this program is live. If you pick yourself out a screen name and a password, you'll be immediately greeted by the likes of Silent R. Lamar and Squeaky and more who will wander in presently. You'll be capably moderated by Pinch It Midweek Chatroom Utility Moderator and all-around great guy, Steve from Georgistan, as well as longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chatroom moderator, Sparky, who, while a third-stage guild navigator, He has decided not to fold space because it's apparently 99 degrees, and so he and Grady the Wonder Dog are sitting under the cool of the air conditioning in Northern California this evening. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday, and we got a bunch of them. But I guess what, the thing that's topmost in my mind is there are certain forces out there that want a war with Iran so bad that they can taste the Ayatollah's blood. Yeah, that's real gross, isn't it? But it's graphic, but it's true. So we'll spend a moment talking about that. As far as where we are right now, we begin every program here with thanks. And so thanks indeed, as follows, to our subscribers for the no longer the loneliest day of the month, the 13th of the month. Thank you to Gary and Gaia out in far distant Oregon. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks as well to Greg. And thanks to Andrea, and thanks to John. And what that means is that the fundraising goal is down around six. It's down to $680. And remember, there is a challenge on the table that will turn that into that will turn every dollar into two that comes in during the pendency of the challenge. And that challenge is down to. Let me see, ciphering, yeah. It's down to $710, so the next $710 that come in get doubled. And that is courtesy of an anonymous member of the Horn Family Community Congregation who wants to see the fundraising monkey off of our backs here, especially in light of the fact that I have to go to D.C. next week to do work on AIC, so there probably won't be five programs next week. There'll be as many as I can get in as the schedule will permit to get in. That's a big deal. Within that, now we've got a challenge within a challenge. The first $100 that come in this evening don't just get doubled, but tripled. Your one becomes three for the first $100. And that's thanks to Chris in Germany, who put forward a Make Bob Ache in D.C. challenge. Okay. Thank you to Chris, and thank you to our anonymous member of the community. So right now, one becomes three, two becomes six, five becomes 15, up to the first $100. And that'll take us down in ever lower. And hopefully, you know, maybe just, you know, if we could just do the evenings, you know, the evenings $200, that'd be awesome. So there we go. There we go. And thanks again to all of the subscribers, because that makes keeping up with things a little bit simpler. Let's see. Dowhead and Anatole have wandered into the room. Good, good. Getting the group, pulling the gang together. But like I said, I woke up this morning to find that those big, playful boys, they're just boys after all, those big, playful boys in the Trump regime apparently have a desperate and abiding desire to see the United States go into a war with Iran. And it is only fair to say that it may not go as well as they think it wants, as they think they want it to. I'm speaking particularly of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. he graduated first in his class at West Point. Just ask him, he'll tell you. Yeah, Ron in Raleigh is thinking along the same lines. False flag, false flag. Today, just after attacks in the Gulf of Oman, Mike Pompeo, you know, he finished first in his class at West Point. Remember, that's great inflation. Declared that it was Iran lashing out. And I don't know about you, but I don't think that the Iranians are crazy or stupid enough when they're in sights of John Woomboom Bolton and the aforementioned Pompeo. They came to the conclusion that it was Iran with no formal investigation at all. These jagoffs think that war with Iran will be a cakewalk. More young Americans in a war. They can't win. Because, you know, let's remember, we didn't win in Iraq. And we damn sure haven't won in Afghanistan. And we're never gonna. Not to put too fine a point on it, but we're never going to win. We can't. So, So what happened, at least as far as I can tell from what I saw this morning... overnight here, but I guess in broad daylight in the Gulf of Oman, which is kind of part of the Persian Gulf. Not kind of, it is. It's a gulf within a gulf, kind of like a challenge within a challenge. Or a play within a play, if you want to get Shakespearean, Hamlet. Among other things, a Japanese tanker was attacked by someone and set ablaze. The crew of 20 or 21, whatever it was, and it amazes me that a vessel that huge, carrying that much crude oil, requires only 20 people to get it from, say, the Persian Gulf to Japan. Eventually, they'll have no human beings aboard, and then they won't have any labor costs, and that'll make the oil companies very happy. But even as the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, was sitting down for the first meeting that a Japanese Prime Minister has had with an Iranian leader in 40 years, Iran decides to take some pot shots at a Japanese oil tanker. You know, if there was any justice in the world, the name of that tanker would have been Kobayashi Maru. You realize that, right? That's our obligatory Star Trek reference, and now it's out of the way early in the program.
because, remember, the Kobayashi Maru represents a no-win situation. Yeah, whoever cooked this up, at the risk of sounding like Alex Jones, whoever cooked this up didn't really think it through. They were scared to death that Japan might somehow see through the sham and flummery that is the bellicose approach of the Trump regime toward Iran. I don't know, but it certainly, as Ron and Raleigh pointed out, it certainly would seem monumentally stupid for the Iranians to do that with them in the midst of such an important meeting. In fact, it makes a lot more sense that maybe we would do something like that in the midst of such an important meeting. Or, you know, one of our toadies or lickspittles or bootlicks countries over in that region. Do I know? No, I don't know. Brother Deacon Asa, on the other hand, says this has got filthy Wahhabi written all over it. And, you know, our majestic, noble, gracious, most puissant partners in peace, the royal house of Ibn Saud, yeah, I could see them doing that. In about, like, a heartbeat. Yeah, no problem. No problem at all in that regard. But in the early coverage that I saw of it, this from the Wall Street Journal. And, of course, the Wall Street Journal leads with oil prices rise sharply amid fears of disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz, through which over a third of the world's seaborne crude is shipped. Even the Wall Street Journal didn't seem to be particularly impressed with what was being put out. But nonetheless, Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, and evangelical fundamentalist homosexual, you know, and remember, even though he, well, or perhaps because he graduated first in his class at West Point, remember, he's one of these people that thinks that you can make certain events come to pass that will then compel the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky to look at his boy and say, get on back down there. And, you know, his boy will look at him and say, Dad, really? I mean, I was peeping through Bob's eyes as he was driving south last week. And, Dad, they got like 80-foot crosses by the road. What are they fucking crucifying down there? Goddamn whales, Dad? I don't wanna. But nonetheless, Mike Pompeo, who can't wait to get his apocalypse on, Mike Pompeo said, this is based on it. Friends and neighbors, cast your mind back. It was a day now long ago at the United Nations when a man of supposed honor, military honor, who had risen to the absolute heights, the pinnacle, if you will, of rank and power in the United States Army, sat before the United Nations and said, My friends, these are not theories. This is not speculation. This is real. Look at these photos of aluminum tubes. And on that flimsy, flim-flam, shabby evidence, we went to war against the innocent people of Iraq and slaughtered north of 1 million innocent civilians on the flimsiest of excuses. This is based on intelligence, General Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, said, not speculation, not guesswork. Well, Mike Pompeo said, this is based on intelligence, the weapons used, the level of expertise needed to execute the operation, recent similar Iranian attacks on shipping, never mentioning that none of that's been proved either, and the fact that no proxy group operating in the area has the resources and proficiency to act with such a high degree of sophistication. That last part is true. There are no proxy groups with the resources and proficiency to act with such a high degree of sophistication. No proxy groups. But we have sold some of the bestest weapons on planet Earth to the noble, gracious, most serene, puissant kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And they damn sure do have the proficiency and the resources to act with such a high degree of sophistication. And if you apply the old Latin maxim, cui bono, to the entire transaction, who benefits by the United States deciding to go to war against Saudi Arabia, or against Iran? Saudi Arabia. Ding! And so they're going to beat this war drum. And as I have observed in the past, it would be nice if we had a vibrant anti-war movement in this country. But we kind of don't. We don't. And I don't know how many members of this Congress will go along with it. Pompeo says he's ordered the U.S. envoy to the United Nations, lickspittle by the name of Jonathan Cohen, to bring the attacks before the U.N. Security Council meeting this afternoon. And then ominously added, the United States will defend its forces, interests, and stand with our partners and allies to safeguard global commerce and regional stability. Global commerce is a euphemism for oil. Because even though we know that the planet is burning, even though we know that we have only a limited amount of time in which to hopefully mitigate the harm of climate change, because it's already started, it's already here, it's already with us, it's already on us, there are still far too many people who derive too much benefit from the viscous, gooey, sacred crude, much of which flows out of the Persian Gulf. Who else benefits, asks Steve in New York. That's right, Russia. They get an endless pipeline of sales of arms to Iran while it uses them up in a war with the U.S. Everybody wins. You know, except for, say, the Iranian mothers-to-be carrying little Iranian babies in their bellies who will be rent into many tiny constituent parts and pieces as the American smart bombs and Tomahawk cruise missiles fly into various parts of that ancient land. They don't win. They don't win. Steve also observes, the Iranian military, this is no Vietnam, Iraq, or Grenada. and in fact, it's not going to be the cakewalk they think it is. All we lack now is someone standing in for Donald Rumsfeld to say that American troops will be greeted as liberators in Iran, and the war will pay for itself. Check me, but I think we're still paying for the credit card bill for the last goddamn war. And I mean that in its purest, most literal sense. God-damned war. So right now we've got a guided missile destroyer toddling around in that dangerous space. Might as well have a big target on it. And, you know, who knows? USS Maine 2.0? Son, you provide the copy and I'll provide the war. William Randolph Hearst is alleged to have said that at the outset of the Spanish-American War in Cuba. Yeah. One hopes that cooler heads will prevail. But I sort of felt that my spidey sense tingle when Trump, when Julius Geezer said, no, I'd prefer to take a softer tone. That meant that he was going to do something vile even then. Pompeo, meanwhile, is putting out feelers for a coalition of the billing. We call upon all nations threatened by Iran to join us in that endeavor. That threatened by Iran part sort of narrows it. Let's see. Threatened by Iran. Well, that would leave out Australia if we start with the A's. I tried to make it like Japan's threatened by Iran, but I don't think anybody's buying. Bhutan is not threatened by Iran, nor is Burkina Faso. Brazil is not threatened by Iran. Colombia, not threatened by Iran. Mexico, not threatened by Iran. The Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, not threatened by Iran. China, not threatened by Iran. But as Steve observes, both China and Russia are, I'm sure, more than happy to play global arms dealer in that regard. Canada, not threatened by Iran. Great Britain, not threatened by Iran. France, Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Norway, Ireland, Italy, Slovenia, Serbia, not threatened by Iran. Israel, not threatened by Iran. South Africa, not threatened by Iran. Egypt, not threatened by Iran. India, not threatened by Iran. Pakistan, not threatened by Iran. We call upon all nations threatened by Iran to join us in that endeavor. Bub, that sounds like you're saying you want the Saudis and the UAE and Qatar. And they'll try to gin something up just so Israel won't feel so left out. Are your proposed partners in bellicosity? God, how stupid are we? Norwegian vessels were damaged in the attack. And there's a certain amount of irony in that because the other story leading the news this day is the interview that the nitwit Nero gave to George Snuffleupagus, in which he said that, of course, he would accept foreign intelligence dirt on his opponent.
And who wouldn't? I mean, let's say Norway shows up and says, we've got some dirt. I'd listen to him.
Oh, but sir, you know, the FBI director says that would be wrong.
Well, the FBI director would be wrong. I mean, if Norway...
he has this obsession with Norway. It's like it's the only country he's aware of. Maybe it's the whitest country he's aware of. I don't know. And then, of course, there was the tweet earlier today that just made me want to eat dirt and run rabbits. In a tweet, Trump referred to Charles, next in line to the British throne, as the, he spelled it this way, Prince of Wales. Wales. With an H. Just like the country in the United Kingdom doesn't have. I think, and I want to put this, and not for Donald Trump's sake, but for the people who labor under developmental delay, my respect. I want to be gentle and not use any pejorative terms. But Donald J. Trump is not euphemistically, but actually and intellectually, mentally deficient. He is slow to the point of non-functioning. That's why his IQ scores are hidden behind a veil of threatening letters from Michael Cohen back when he was doing his dirty work. But we have evidence, Prince of Wales, or the professor he had at Wharton, who said he was the dumbest goddamned human being he had ever had in a classroom. Prince of Wales.
Norway, it's a country, Norway.
So I don't know about you, but I am not, no, I'm not impressed. And in the meantime, the Ayatollah in Iran has suggested to Shinzo Abe that Trump is not worthy of a response from Iran. Which is saying something. Jesus, God. So I don't... Yeah, Pompeo went on and said, taken as, you know, he graduated first in his class at West Point. Taken as a whole, these unprovoked attacks present a clear threat to international peace and security, a blatant assault on the freedom of navigation, and an unacceptable campaign of escalating tension by Iran. Objection, Your Honor. Assumes facts not in evidence. Objection sustained. Nitwit Nero said of the meeting, sort of giving the game away, between Abe and Khamenei,
"While I very much appreciate PM Abe going to Iran to meet with Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, I personally feel that it is too soon to even think about making a deal. They are not ready, and neither are we."
Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif said, it's suspicious, said suspicious doesn't begin to describe what likely transpired this morning. And if you were going to hit a ship and you wanted a really big boom, big fireworks show, then what better to hit than the Front Altair? That's the Norwegian vessel that was carrying a hold full of naphtha, liquid hydrocarbon, that goes boom real big. Meanwhile, over in the markets where people worry about nothing but money, 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 money all day long. Grub, 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 grub. Well, oil prices leapt by about 4%. On, you know, fears. Because the global commodities markets are essentially chihuahuas that cower under the bed at the sound of a door slamming loudly. Interestingly, although the two Norwegian ships have now been damaged, Norway has yet to place blame on anyone for these things. Last week, the commander of U.S. forces in the region said the threat is imminent that Iran or its proxies would make an attack. These people are so transparently criminal, so obviously engaged in a filthy, crooked game that the only people who can't see that are the people who desperately want a war. There's none so blind as those who will not see. Yeah, Asa, I agree. Brother Deacon Asa says, pretty audacious of this obese fuck in the White House to be fat-shaming Prince Charles, don't you think? See, that's the sad thing. He wasn't fat-shaming. He can't spell whales. It has an H in it in his head for him. He's that goddamn stupid. In regard to cognitive decline, Lee offers up a lengthy quote from Trump and says, this is not simplistic, it's incomprehensible. And it's not consistent with someone deciding to dumb down their verbiage, which is known as style shifting. It's consistent with someone who is having trouble organizing their thoughts and having trouble remaining focused. Both are symptoms of cognitive decline. Steve in New York. Oil prices leapt. I'll bet Jerry Falwell Jr. will have a nice payday. Doesn't he sell jet fuel to the U.S. government? He does. Ron in Raleigh says, what if an Australian tanker took a hit? Would the name of that tanker be Botany Bay? Botany Bay. Oh, well played, Ron. Well played indeed. Botany. Come on, we have to get out of here now. Quick. I watched that opening sequence the other night. That's why it. God, Wrath of Khan was such a good movie. Ron adds, I'm thinking the Saudis have the tech, but I believe the execution would fall to the Israelis. They're sneakier. That's not anti-Semitic, damn it. Did you hear that after this month we'll no longer hear the dulcet tones of Jethreen Hasselbalch's Sandbags? Good riddance. I did hear that. She's leaving next month, according to the headlines. And did I read somewhere that Trump is saying that she should run for governor of Arkansas? Yeah, you do that, Jethrine. You do that. The sad thing is, they'd probably elect her. Yeah, Jack in Shreveport says, I got to give a cowbell to the Bethany Bay thing, too. No, that was perfectly timed and absolutely needed in this circumstance. Jethrine Bodine, Hustlebuck Sandbags, has been getting some fond farewells. Okay, they aren't fond. Will she open, moving to Arkansas, where she will open her own farm and raise liars? Let the truth hit her on the way out. Good riddance, pathological propagandist. Who will lie by the helicopter now? Some people calling for the return of Sean Spicer. Well, that would be delightful. If a foreign government offered you a Sarah Huckabee Sanders, would you go to the FBI? And remember, she confessed to openly lying about all those FBI agents who told her they were so terribly, terribly, terribly demoralized. In regard to Iran, Megan says, I'm suspicious. This all sounds like a lead-up to declare war on Iran to me, just in time for Julius Caesar to prevent an election in 2020 because war president. Well, see, that's the funny thing. There will be no declaration. We haven't declared war on anybody since we declared war on Japan and Germany and Italy. Didn't declare war on Korea. Didn't declare it on Vietnam. Presidents just get to go to war now. No. I'm not biting. I'm just not biting. Well, there's an idea. Brother Deacon Asa says, quite frankly, I think they should bring back the mooch. The mooch, as the White House spokes dipshit. The mooch, he had the class. Yeah, you know he did. Robert in Australia, it ain't funny, but don't worry, Bob, we'll be there. War with Iran, we have one of those treaties that ensure we get dragged into every stupid war the USA has. Vietnam, we were there. Iraq, we were there. Australian Special Forces were the first over the border. Long term, it probably won't matter. The Adani coal mine has been given the go-ahead. Yeah. And lo and behold, the guy, I should mention that Dr. Michael Hendricks, the man who's shown the light on the toxic effects, the terminal effects, the mortal effects of mountaintop removal in communities here in Appalachia. Even as we speak, here in the dead of the Australian winter, well, late autumn, he's wrapping up about a year up over down under, documenting that the very same damn things are happening in coal communities in Oz. And more's the pity. Speaking of things taking place up over down under, in New Zealand, Brenton Tarrant, the guy who slaughtered 51 human beings at two mosques in New Zealand, has entered a plea of not guilty to charges of both murder and terrorism. I didn't expect him to plead guilty. It would have been nice. But now the families of those who were butchered by that right-wing piece of shit fascist, well, they're going to have to ride out a long and hateful trial process that starts, according to the scheduling order issued, on May the 4th, 2020. One thing, of course, he'll do is try to use the trial as a platform for his fascism. Jesus. Sarah Huckleberry is leaving, says Steve in New York, because Satan decided he wants his money back. Good one. Well played. This, real quick, like, there's a reporter at CNN by the name of Phil Mattingly. On air today, he told the story of a nameless, anonymous Republican member of the House of Representatives who, having seen Nitwit Nero's interview with George Snuffleupagus, in which he said he would welcome foreign interference in the election, that is, dirt offered by foreign intelligence agencies on, say, his opponent. Phil Mattingly said he received a text. He did not identify the Republican House member. This Republican lawmaker texted him three words. Mattingly said, after the interview broke, I got a text message from a Republican House member which had three words. Why? Just why? Explaining those three words, Mattingly said, as in, why even invite this and why bring this on and why say that everybody does it because everybody does not do it? Everybody operates in opposition research, but not from a foreign entity or foreign adversary. Okay. But why, just why, does this Republican get the luxury of remaining anonymous? Mattingly had an explanation for that, too. They have to furrow brows and raise concern because they're scared to death of Donald Trump sicking the maggots on them. But behind the scenes, Phil Mattingly says, make no mistake about it, Republicans and Democrats alike don't agree with that position. Well, I think it's fairly clear that Democrats don't, but if Republicans don't, they need to stop hiding their light under a bushel and let their little light shine for all the world to see. Over in the Senate, North Carolina's Thom Tillis, who will never, ever be included in any volume called Profiles in Courage, a lot of Republicans had microphones shoved in their faces today after that interview. And he said, well, you know, he personally would go to the FBI. But then, because he's scared to death of being primaried by a maggot, and I think he's already being primaried by a maggot, he said, I think that, again, you have to listen to the entire discussion where the president said that if he felt something was wrong, he'd reach the authorities. No, he really didn't. I'll leave it up to the president to use good judgment. I'll leave it up to Typhoid Mary to wash her hands. I'll leave it up to the Vlad Dracula to keep his fangs to himself on dark, moonless nights. I'll leave it to a rabid dog not to bite. Good judgment. I mean, naturally, I'd call the authorities if I was placed in the same situation. We should have better awareness that this is what we should all do when we get information from a foreign entity that's trying to meddle in our elections. I don't think there's a problem with the Democrats knowing that's what they do. But it's the Republic. It's sort of like, did you see Jon Stewart show up in Congress the other day? And I'm not gooning on Jon Stewart. But he sat there and lectured the House Judiciary Committee over reauthorization of the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. File this under Don't Shit on Your Friends. Using broad, sweeping language, he accused the Congress of doing nothing and simply letting the first responders from September 11th, 2001, low 18 years ago, languish. On Jon Stewart's part, that was not true. I mean, he had a moment there in front of the Congress that was similar to the time he showed up with Tucker Carlson and, the guy who wasn't James Carville, the Clinton guy, and told them both to stop being dicks and essentially canceled Crossfire in one fell swoop. And not because I'm some sort of hopeless partisan, but because I believe that the country benefits by having the truth told to it. It would have been far more honest, and it would have been far more accurate for Jon Stewart to have said, the Republicans have failed to act. Because that's the simple fact of the matter. Democrats aren't failing to act on the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. And yes, I sat there watching it thinking, hey, John, what if I could tell you that every 3 years here in Central Appalachia, we have a 9/11? What if I could tell you that those same diseases caused by ultra-fine particles in lower Manhattan as the towers came down. What if I could tell you, Jon Stewart, that they kill 1,000 people in West Virginia every year? 1,000 people you've never heard of, Jon Stewart. 1,000 people you don't care about, Jon Stewart, because they're only hillbillies. They're not even really American. What about that? That's what I'm going to D.C. next week to work on, along with my colleague Bo Webb. Relief from a constant barrage of poisonous dust all over Central Appalachia. The Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. Now, it doesn't do anything ambitious like setting up a victims' compensation fund, although it goddamned well should. It just politely asks that we stop the coal companies from poisoning the hillbillies. As usual, we hillbillies, we're not asking for anything, and we don't want to check. We'll go quietly to our grim goddamn deaths. But we'd like for it to maybe stop so that the death can stop at the youngest current generation. But opioids. Yeah, no. Mountaintop removal has killed a hell of a lot more Appalachian people than opioids. Just have. And so while Tom Tillis wants to lecture, we all, when we get information from a foreign entity, I mean, really, do you think Sweden is beating down Bernie Sanders' door with dirt on Donald Trump? Because I don't. Do you think the Germans are coming in over the transom to give dirt on Donald Trump to Elizabeth Warren? Because I don't. But Tom Tillis wants to. I'll leave it up to the president to use good judgment. Yeah. I'll leave it up to Genghis Khan to exhibit mercy. And why not? And meanwhile, as Flavio reminds me, legislation has been introduced to halt arms sales to Saudi Arabia again. Republican Justin Amash and Democrat Ted Lieu introduced a resolution yesterday to stop the arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to the tune of some $8.1 billion. This came after a hearing about arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Senator Elizabeth Warren has also chimed in, requesting that the Inspector General of the State Department investigate the involvement of Charles Faulkner, a State Department official, in the decision to trigger emergency powers to waive required congressional review of planned arms sales. This was all done for the benefit of Raytheon, which, curiously, is a client of Charles Faulkner's former lobbying firm. Who'd have thunk? Ron in Raleigh says, today on My Filthy Little Habit, there was an interview with one of the far-right leaders in Italy. His name is, wait for it, Gaius Julius Caesar Mussolini. You pulling my leg, Ron? Signore Mussolini said that many Italians appreciated the good things his great-grandfather did for the country during his run. The fascistas are gaining power in the Italian legislature. Another country turns right. We get much more right turning. We're gonna spin this planet out of its goddamned orbit. Oh, and I had a note earlier today from Lady B that merits sharing. Lady B wrote, "I think I'm a socialist. I didn't know Bernie Sanders the first time around. Vermont was one of those white people states where they all talk funny and talk about lobsters all the time. That's what they talk about in Vermont. But I've gotten to know a little more about him since Trump was elected. He has the power of conviction. He's sincere. After reading his speech today, I think I'm going to vote for him. Of course, it's still too early to tell, and I like Warren, but I really liked his speech a lot. And I believe this is the only way we will ever come back from becoming an oligarchy." Well, I would add editorially, parenthetically, perhaps the only way we will stop already being an oligarchy or take corrective measures, because I think we already is one. "I believe I'm a socialist at heart. That might be easy to say when you're as broke as I am, but that doesn't mean I'm completely anti-capitalist. It doesn't mean you can't become rich. It just means you'll pay your fair share of taxes. You will not lord over the world with your money. You'll not rule the human race. You will not be better than us all. Save that shit for actors to play on TV. The planet is dying, and we can slow it down, but it will die. Right now, we ain't doing shit to stop it. Capitalism does that to people. Tells them to fuck the consequences, live in the moment, consume. We can't continue living this way. We got to be more socialist or we're all going to suffer and die. Dirty air don't discriminate. It will affect the rich eventually, especially when there's no one to work for them. Thanks for all you do. Thanks for all you say, Lady B. The funny thing is, what Bernie says is socialism isn't. And I've remarked before that I think he would have made a lot more traction and he would have taken a lot of fangs out of the bite of the other side by simply calling himself what he really is. And what he really is a Democrat from the old school. What he really is an FDR Democrat. Last night I mentioned in passing the park that's been created on the TVA reservation down in the Shoals where I was Monday. I just happened on it, but I saw CCC Camp Park, and I knew I had to drive in and at least have a look. Socialistic is different from socialist. And you can make an argument that the Civilian Conservation Corps was socialistic. Because it used the power and money of government to put people who desperately needed work to work and thereby saved the lives of individuals, of families, and of entire generations. And that's just being an FDR Democrat. Now, sure, back then, the Republicans said FDR was a traitor to his class. After FDR died in office and was succeeded by Harry Truman, Harry Truman observed, "They call everything they don't like socialism," talking about the Republicans. But to simply use the powers of government for the greatest good for the greatest number isn't necessarily socialism. If we had real socialism in the United States, the entire power grid would be owned by the government. There would be one oil company, the government. Now, we can have an argument, a discussion, not an argument. We can have a discussion over the relative merits of that. I think the government taking over health care and running health care in the United States the way that Medicare is run would probably be highly efficient, much more efficient than paying health insurance company CEOs enough money to buy a small planet with their Christmas bonus. Yeah. We know that one of the single most effective organizations out there is the Social Security Administration, whose administrative costs, as compared to other retirement money operations, are almost infinitesimal. But if Bernie had said, "I'm an FDR Democrat," I think we'd be a lot further down the road. And it would have opened up a door and an opportunity to teach a generation who don't even know who FDR was the brilliance of the man and the compassion of the man. And the hell place from which he pulled this country. So that's that, you know, if wishes were horses, right? But I far prefer the term FDR Democrat to Democratic Socialist. You want a good distinction between FDR Democrat and Socialist? Compare FDR to Eugene V. Debs. And man, if the younger generations don't know who FDR was, Eugene who? And Eugene Debs was a man of great conviction and great sincerity, but he really did want a very different America from what probably the majority of Americans want or wanted. And so by giving the Republicans and the right wing generally the gift on a gilded platter of the word socialism with which to brugga, people who have been dumbed down over the course of two generations, well, it wasn't helping. Vermont lobsters? Asks Lee in New York. Please tell Lady B that Vermont is landlocked. Not really a lobster place. Try the maple syrup. Yeah, in Vermont they talk about maple syrup. In New Hampshire they talk about lobsters. All right. So we've reached the top of the hour. And we're trying to take advantage of this matching challenge that's on the table. $710 and plus a $100 challenge this evening, courtesy of Chris in Germany. It's a chance to turn a dollar contribution into three. And it would be nice if we could get off the schneid and not finish the program with a goose egg. That's all I'm going to say about it, because I'm excited. I'm happy. Because it's Thursday, the 13th of June, and we haven't heard from our buddy Dan Fisher in far too long. But Dan is with us this evening. Hey, Dan.
Hey, can you hear me?
I hear you. I've got a bad cord here, so let me jiggle it a little bit. You know how it goes with those bad patch
just
cords.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Jiggle it. Okay. I can hear droves of listeners tuning out for me trying to do some 80s style.
Yeah, let me just... Okay, go ahead. You're a little bit low. I don't know if some of that's you and some of that's me or exactly how that works, but.
We'll be back in a moment, folks.
The girl from Ipanema goes walking in. See, I knew what
you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, so this actually occurred to me before coming on, because at about 10 till 7. I said to myself, you know what you need to do, Dan Fisher, as I often say to myself, you should go to the bathroom before you go on, because once you're on, you're not using the bathroom. So what do you do, Bob and Kate? You do this 3 hours a night, five nights a week, as far as I know. And what do you do when you have to pee?
I generally hold it. When things get really, really dire, I play Stairway to Heaven.
Really? Have you done it? You put Stairway to Heaven on for your people to listen to, and you run away to the Bob room?
Yes, because, I mean, nobody, behold, no one hath the perfect bowel. Well, there went dinner in the central time zone, so, but... Yeah, I mean, it's a reality, and Stairway to Heaven was the savior of many a DJ, especially on the overnight shift.
Well, I was just thinking too that, you know, that way people could get way more information than they thought might ever want about your habits, in that if you come back while the song is still slow, they know that you were urinating. But if you get all the way to, you know, the big speeded up part and
when we wind on down the road, yes.
Get into politics at some point or other too, because, you know, people do talk about that stuff from time to time. Politics, I mean, versus your particular bathroom habits.
But, you know, sure, that's what makes this these conversations so delightful. I can never be entirely sure where we're going to go, Dan. Or for that matter, under the circumstances, when we're going to go. Wait a minute, I'm giving myself a cowbell for that. Okay.
They say that if you make enough left turns, you wind up making a right, right? So,
right.
And I don't mean that in the political left or right.
No, no, no. Two wrongs don't make a right, but two rights did make an airplane.
You are a dad, because that is a dad joke. Or actually, it's even more. That's like my fourth grade social studies teacher's version of jokes. You know, he'd come in wearing his plaid pants, and, you know, it's Friday, so he thought he'd give us a break by warming us up with some, you know, history-based humor, and we just weren't having it at age 12 or so, age 10 maybe.
You know, you got to go with what you got, and if dad jokes, you know.
Principal jokes, you know, when he sits you down in the office and you're all nervous, and he tries to sort of butter you up a little bit before he goes in for the kill with some sort of this is going to hurt you more than it hurts me joke of some sort, then you know you're getting it bad.
And by the way, Arnold just wrote in, and Arnold is down with Stairway to Heaven. Arnold says, that's some totally old school Stairway to Heaven. Go to the bathroom, get laid, get high, move your car.
Wow. That's all done much more quickly than I like to do any of it, especially the number two in the bathroom thing. Not that anybody's clamoring for this either, but
all of that can be done within Stairway to Heaven. And if you're feeling really froggy, you queue up in Agata De Vita.
Well, you know, people have asked me from time to time, Dan, how is it that you know every single Oscar winner, that is picture, actor, and actress, from 1927 up to present time? How, like, not only why, but how did you accomplish this dubious feat? And it's because I have this wonderful book about the history of the Oscars in the bathroom, and you know what? You can't bring the phone in all the time. Sometimes you get too grossed out by that, and you just need some good old-fashioned pages while you do this thing. And so, therefore, I know that in 1946, the Best Picture winner was anybody? Bueller? Best Years of Our
Best
Lives.
I was wow. You started. I was going there.
Sorry.
No, I love that film.
Sure, it's a great film. You know, it's a much better film than 1989's Best Picture winner, which was...
Got Nothing.
Driving Miss Daisy.
Oh,
lordy, lordy, lordy.
I'll be driving Miss Daisy. Yeah.
Let's not even go to 1995's Best Picture winner. Crash. No, 2005. 2005, sorry. Crash was 2005's winner.
The Academy is not always on the button.
No, but God bless them. They put on a show every year. But it's too early to talk about the Oscars. I mean, we're into the summer movie extravaganza lupada.
Right, the vast wasteland of blockbusters.
Well, it would be blockbusters. I heard the new Shaft sucks, and I heard that the what other movie did they remake that just came out? Just what is it? It's all remakes now.
I'm gonna run this one past you. I saw an article last night saying that Quentin Tarantino still has an itch to make an R-rated Star Trek, and I sat here and swore at the computer screen.
Well, I don't know. I have the same feeling about the current revival of Oklahoma on Broadway, which some of my friends have loved. The New York friends have loved, you know, the artsy let's rip up everything traditional crowd, and then the folks who have come in from other states and they've got just one weekend in town and went to see the new Oklahoma, which is I guess dark and so forth, they can't stand it. But I'm all in favor of taking something beloved by everybody and just trying to turn it into punk rock, and let's just see what happens. And the worst that can happen is, well, in the case of Broadway, you've wasted anywhere from $200 to a couple of thousand bucks on a night you can never get back. So that is pretty bad. So I agree with those people that maybe that isn't such a good idea. But anyway, here I am. I'm just so malleable. You know, I have the convictions of a stick of butter, boy. I just bend and melt whichever way you want me to go. How are you, Bob? Did you go to the bathroom?
No, I didn't. I'm right here. But I wanted to, you mentioned Oklahoma on Broadway, and I wanted to ask if you're getting here, you know, from your theater going friends, any word on the quality or lack thereof of the Aaron Sorkin To Kill a Mockingbird?
Most people I know people I personally know went to see it love it. I have read some critics that, you know, there's always going to be things of, is it necessary or is it racist? Is it not racist? You know, once again, we've got the narrative as seen through the eyes of a white man. No matter how great Jeff Daniels is, you know, why can't there be a version of To Kill a Mockingbird that tells the story from what's his last name?
Tom Robinson.
Who's represented by Tom Robinson.
Tom Robinson fell on his knife. You know, that kind of thing.
No, that was Bob Ewell.
Yeah. Bob Ewell.
Anyway, what do I think? Why don't you turn it inside out and let's tell it from the perspective of Tom Robinson sometime, or the maid Calpurnia, I think was her name.
That would be good. That would be good. Yeah. Yes. I read a piece.
I haven't seen it the same way that I still haven't seen. What is it? Green Book. So I really got to watch my mouth, because for all I know, these things are every bit more enlightened than I could ever imagine them.
Well, the reason I asked is because I saw an opinion piece by the guy who plays Tom Robinson, who said, you know, it's the opportunity of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. Spoke glowingly, and but he told an anecdote about meeting some theatergoers after the show, and he said, at first you understand that word is going to be prevalent in this script, and we know what I mean by that word.
That word, okay, yes.
And he said, I have to, you know, you're not you, you're the character.
Right.
But he said, after a while, it became like a blunt instrument. And it began to wear on him. And he said that these two little old white ladies who go to the, you know, who go to the theater, because going to the theater on Broadway ain't cheap.
No, it is not.
And that's before you even get to the popcorn. They just walked up to him and used that word.
You mean like after the show?
Yeah. And he said, I wondered what we had done wrong, I think is what it is. What had we done that made them feel comfortable so casually using that word in a conversation with me?
You know, maybe it's the thing of, well, you know, Kanye gets to say it. Why don't I get to say it? Or, you know, a fictional character gets to, it's just a word, you know. Before we go down that path, and we could trot it.
Yeah, we can get real heavy real fast.
Yeah, and I am white, and I am 55, and you are white, and you're around that age. I don't know, you know, if I were to go further and further into this, I think I would want to have like a third person on the line who is not a white man, and especially who is not white, period, to kind of help me out on this one. Because, you know, as always, things keep evolving. And I got to just keep trying to keep up with them. You know, listen, once upon a time when I played Elvis Costello's Armed Forces album, the song Oliver's Army was on, and it has that word in it. And it's used ironically, it's used cynically, it's used as in a character's voice. And it makes a political point using that word. On the other hand, Elvis Costello is a white man. He gets to use that word, and he gets to defend it. And at the time, I felt thoroughly okay with singing along to that, including using that word when I sang along. You know this. You know that song, right? Oliver's Army.
I do indeed.
Yeah, and he's got that line: "One more widow, one less white N-word."
Yep.
So it's like, well, it's white N-word, so that's not really. No. Let's not roll
work
over
that.
Ourselves.
Here. And just so you'll know that this wasn't just me reaching for something controversial, I actually, it occurred to me. When I asked you, when I mentioned Quentin Tarantino wanting to make a Star Trek movie.
Uh-huh.
I immediately thought back to Django Unchained, which seemed to have just a downright gratuitous amount of that.
Well, and you know, I love Quentin as an artist, and I've seen all of his movies.
You ever worked on one of his sets?
No, he's an LA guy, and also too, I don't know if I'd want to. I mean, he's a genius, and I love his movies. I think the intensity of him would just wear me to a frazzle. He seems to be a very, very intense person, and I don't think I would please him. I think at some point I would make some mistake, and it would just be all hell broke loose. I don't know. It's just too much pressure. I think I'm not doing that anymore anyway. I'm not prop mastering, and right now I'm very happy to not prop master.
Speaking of right now, you're working.
Yes, I am. Let's just review to the newbies who might not be tired of me just yet or not know much about me. I underwent a heart transplant in September. So I guess that's been 8.5 months since I had a 25-year-old heart jammed into my 55-year-old body. And I went back to work on Valentine's Day, February 14th. And I've been working ever since. So, yeah, I'm on a new job now. I think I'm allowed to talk a little bit about it because it's an ABC. It's a show that ABC is producing. I'm not sure if it's going to go on ABC Network or on one of their streaming channels or something. It's a reboot of the movie, the John Cusack movie, High Fidelity. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
Only it's set in present time in like hipster Brooklyn, and the main character is not John Cusack, it's Zoe Kravitz. It's a young black woman who's really into vinyl, and so she has a vinyl record shop in modern day Brooklyn. And like the John Cusack character in the movie, at least the episodes we're doing in season one are about her looking back on many of her relationships and trying to figure out how she screwed it up. And so a lot of the episodes will take like a particular ex-boyfriend or current boyfriend and sort of examine in a comedic way, what went wrong this time, and using a lot of really great music, because she's into music and music is so important to her. Inevitably, it's more important to her than which guy she's dating or is she in love at all. As long as she has David Bowie or Tribe Called Quest, life is going to be good.
God, so okay. So this is one of those tangential moments. That reminds me of the scene in Diner.
Yeah,
where there, remember, it all revolves around one of the buddy group. He's getting married.
Yeah, the Daniel Stern character.
Yes,
he's getting married to the Ellen Barkin character.
Right, and she has to pass a trivia test.
Oh, no, wait a minute. I'm sorry. That's Steve Guttenberg is the trivia test.
Yeah,
sorry about that. And we never see the face of the bride.
Did we not?
We don't. At the very end, her back is to us, and she throws the bouquet, and it lands in the midst of the guys instead of the girls. So that's like the last shot.
And there's this obscure reference to Clarence Frogman Henry.
Well, maybe you're getting these mixed up, because Daniel Stern's character is obsessed with music.
Right. Yeah.
He's married.
Oh, no, she has to take the Baltimore Colts test.
That's right. Whereas Daniel Stern's character is the only one in that gang of young men who is married. And you know, he is blessed enough to be married to Ellen Barkin.
I knew Ellen Barkin was in it.
Right.
Yeah.
But they, you know, it's hard being married in general. And it's hard being married when you suspect that you're too young to have gotten married in the first place. And that character one night comes home and he finds that his wife has well-meaningly reorganized his record collection. I think she did.
God, I love your memory.
Alphabetically. And so, but he's like, no, you can't put the R&B next to the rockabilly. You know, there's no way that James Brown goes next to Billy Burnett. You know?
Yeah.
It makes no sense. And she's like, why are you so obsessed with this? It's silly. It's just music. And that is the ultimate insult to him. It's just music. What do you mean? He's pull out any record from this club, any of them. And she pulls out a 45, and he says, what's on the A side? She says, Shake, Rattle, and Roll by Bill Haley and the Comets. And he says, flip it over. Now I'll tell you the B side, it's whatever it was. Da, 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 da. And she's amazed. And he can do that with any record in his collection. It's important to him. I relate. Maybe of all the characters in that movie, that's the one with whom I most relate is the Daniel Stern character in Diner. Because I'm
Daniel,
obsessed about
you're both
movies.
Daniels, you know.
We're both Daniel, my brother. You're older than me. Yeah, but we're obsessed about something.
Ooh, wait a minute. That one just blew past.
Woo! You know, yeah. I just did an Elton John reference.
Yes, you did. I caught it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I totally get how something silly is yet somehow so important. This is why I know that in 1934, the Best Picture winner was It Happened One Night, which was the first time that both a movie swept picture, actor, and actress, and director. Clark Gable, Claudette Colbert, and Frank Capra.
Wonderful
now,
film.
If my car breaks down on the side of the highway, this does me no good.
Unless the tow truck driver is a film buff.
Yeah, and he's like, look, if you can tell me, who won da-da-da-da-da in this year, I'll repair your car for free. Then I'm in like Flynn. But otherwise, forget it. I've got to take out my credit card and pay good money because I don't know how to change the oil in a car. And if he happens to not speak English very well, I'm also screwed because guess what else I don't know? Any other language but English.
And you're probably not up on the entire planet of film.
No, but I'm trying to catch up.
I'm sure you got Akira Kurosawa down pretty good.
I got my Kurosawa, I got my Fellini. I'm getting used to Agnes Varda and some of the other less, you know. I'm going beyond 101 into like 102 or 103, but that's pretty erudite stuff. I mean, most Americans don't watch any foreign cinema. You know what I just watched recently? And I swear, folks, we'll get to politics if that's what you want tonight. But I watched Pan's Labyrinth recently. Have you ever seen that?
I love that film.
Oh, my God. And it is a political film. It's an anti-fascist.
You can't get any more political than that film.
Yeah. And in that same year, another Mexican director, Alfonso Cuarón, made Children of Men. And that's another heavily political film disguised as a very extraordinarily entertaining movie. You know, both of those movies are you know, they're, you could sit down and have as good a time watching that as you could any Marvel movie. They're exciting, they're well shot, they're visually gorgeous, and yet, you know, what are they saying? Stand up against oppression, you know. Fight for what's right. Be willing to lay your life on the line if what comes out of it is the betterment of society.
I wonder how many people watched, and I watched it repeatedly because I loved it. I wonder how many people watched The Motorcycle Diaries and were able to put aside, you know, their, like, anti-Castro fixations. Because God, I loved that movie. The soundtrack, the cinematography, the acting, everything. Just loved it.
Okay, here's an example that I ain't seen everything in this world. My mom got me that DVD, The Motorcycle Diaries. She's like, oh, you'll love this movie. You just got to see it. I put it in the shelf. I haven't watched it, and that's been probably at least 5 years. Sorry, Mom, if you're listening, I haven't taken advantage of that very lovely present.
I'm doing my best, Mrs. Fisher.
But but since we're starting out with entertainment for a change, I wanted to also make mention of something I got into this week, which is a podcast that's available on Spotify. Do you do Spotify, Bob, or are you part of that? I don't know what the hell that is.
No, my stuff goes up on Spotify.
Oh, great. Well, there's a podcast on there called Stay Free, which is not about feminine hygiene products. It's the story of The Clash.
I gotta.
And it's narrated by Chuck D of Public Enemy. And Chuck D, in the very first episode, says, you know, I'm a huge Clash fan. Because and when we started out to form Public Enemy, which if you guys aren't old enough or aware enough to know, Public Enemy was one of the first rap groups that mattered, hip hop that mattered. I mean, there was also Grandmaster Flash. There were a lot of them, but it takes a nation of millions. That was a huge album that along with Beastie Boys, you know, really helped break serious hip hop into the mainstream, while people still thought that Vanilla Ice and MC Hammer were as hardcore as it got. But anyway, Chuck D narrates the history of the Clash. It's an 8-part, half an hour each episode series. You know, you can commute a couple of times back and forth, and by the end of it, you get the history of the Clash. And I've always been a big, huge fan. You know, London Calling was just on permanent rotation on the turntable in our college years. I mean, I know that, like, you and I listened to Guns of Brixton many, many times.
And I realized I had achieved geezerdom not too long back when I was in the grocery store and Train.
Oh, yeah, you told me this.
Yeah, and Train in Vain was playing.
That's right.
Yep.
Do you know why they called it Train in Vain, by the way?
No, I don't.
Folks listening at home, I like to put little asterisks to you guys, because I hope this isn't so inside baseball that people are like, what is Train in Vain? What is that song? You might know this if you've been in a grocery store or had a radio for the past 30 years. It's a song that goes, "Didn't stand by me, no, not at all. Say you stand by your man." You know that song.
Yep.
Now, why don't they call it Stand By Me? Because Joe Strummer is a huge music fan, not just of punk, because he's dead now. He loved R&B, too. And he's like, I don't want to call this song Stand By Me, because that's Benny King. He got there first. And he said, why Train in Vain? Is because they thought that Topper Heaton's drums on that song sounded like a train going down the track. It's sort of like chunk chugga tunk chugga tunk. I don't agree, actually. I listened to it again. I'm like, it doesn't sound like a train.
Yeah, I didn't hear that, no.
But they did, and that's why they called it Train in Vain.
And it was also an obvious single and not listed on the actual vinyl.
Yeah, and they'll tell you why if you listen to Stay Free, the Story of the Clash.
Oh, tomorrow's one of my mornings when I have to get up at 5:30 and take my son to work. So I've got a 30-minute drive home that will see me listening to episode 1 of Stay Free.
Cool. Cool, yeah.
I have Dan Fisher to thank for it.
Well, you know, that's what's really... This is what's cool about my life right now. Besides the fact that I'm not dead because of a bum heart, what's also cool about my life, and the fact that my son just graduated from college, and the fact that my wife still likes having me around. But there's something else that's cool about my life, which is that, you know, I did this... I'm still doing this 200-part everyday thing on Facebook called Movies That I've Loved, where every single day, for some reason, I post a 300 to 500-page essay on a movie that I at least loved once, if not still loved. And most of the times, I still love them. I do this every day. And throughout the time I've done it, I can't tell you, it's been at least 10 times where people have replied in the comments, you know, I watched this because you recommended it. And it's like, that's just the best feeling in the world. You know, I can't change people's political thoughts. I can't change, you know, a whole lot about them, but I got somebody to give something a try, you know, that may or may not be something they like, but at least they tried it, because just because I wrote 500 words about it and it convinced them. So you saying that, like, my recommending this, that's an honor too. That just gives me a big old kick.
And today you put one out of the park with one of my favorite comedies of all time.
yeah, it's A Mad, 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 Mad World. I mean, I can't say it's one of my favorite comedies in the world. I mean, it's up in my top 10. I mean, it's way too long. It's 3.5 hours, or close to it. 3:19, I think. It could be an hour shorter, and it could be maybe the funniest movie ever made. It's sort of like the White Album by the Beatles, where there's just way too much stuff. But on the other hand, it's all at least very good, and some of it's just pure genius. And anything with, like, Buddy Hackett, you know, crossing his eyes as he makes a plane flip upside down, or Jonathan Winters pretty much doing anything. That's, you got me right there.
Well, see, you and I have this, well, I mean, it's not a you and I thing, but it's...
Just you and I sharing our dreams together. Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Well, I'm in a good mood.
No. It's great. It's great. No, the one you did yesterday, The Graduate... So I read this story last night, and it's a damned horror. Human beings on the planet, and especially people in places like Merca, some scientists have determined that we consume something on the order of about a credit card's worth of microplastics a year, I think was what the story said.
Mm.
Plastic. Nom, nom, it's nom. What's for... And so, and so last night as I read the story, I immediately thought back to The Graduate.
Yeah.
And that classic line, plastics. Plastics.
Yep. And you know what? The guy was not wrong.
It's not wrong, and it may be the perfect epitaph for humanity. Plastics.
I mean, if Ben could follow that plastics up with silicon chips, he would be king of California. But that's another story. But no, I kind of pissed on The Graduate a little bit in my essay, and you could tell which of my friends actually read the thing versus just clicking on like because they like The Graduate and they saw the picture. I always make sure to include a picture with the essay because you know that gets people's attention too. But I kind of pissed on The Graduate a little bit. I mean, I still like it a lot. I like the acting, and Bancroft's just incredible, and there's a lot of wonderful things in it. But on the other hand, first of all, why is Ben so ashamed to be seen with Mrs. Robinson? I mean, she's more sexually appealing than Elaine, really, and Elaine is really just a prop. Elaine is
about as two-dimensional as you can get.
All she is, and this is not exclusive to The Graduate, all she is a prize. She is a prize won by the hero at the end. And this is very often the case, where if Tom Cruise can learn how to be the best pilot, if somebody can learn to beat somebody up, they get a girlfriend. The girlfriend just immediately magnetizes onto that guy because he is a winner. And that's what she wants. She is a prize for his achieving something. And, you know, I just think we can do a little better than that. And you know, movies are like, you know, they're just fossilized. They're embedded in amber forever. Whatever they were, whatever they represented at the time, that's what they're going to be. And we in the audience may change and evolve. But, you know, even the Marx Brothers, which you know, I love and will always make me laugh. I mean, you know, Groucho has a few... not particularly enlightened asides about the racism in his movies. You know, and at the time, they were gangbusters, you know, because it was like, ha, 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 weren't the darkies something? Well, no, they weren't. Or, they were something. They were people. And, I'm still going to love the Marx Brothers. And I'm still contemplating what the hell I feel about National Lampoon's Animal House or MASH, which are still very funny and very innovative movies, except they happen to be quite misogynist.
No, I was going to say misogynistic as hell. And Mrs. Robinson comes off as a villain.
Yeah, yeah. And also the thing, too, about The Graduate is at the time, I was 4 years old or 3 years old when it came out. So I wasn't there. But my impression is a lot of people were like, right on. You know, you aren't going to just accept what the establishment wants you to be. You're going to do your own thing, man. Well, you know, what is he really doing? You know, and I'm old enough now that I'm like, you know what? You really should get a job, Benjamin. I mean, if my son came home from college, and my son is coming home from college in about a week or so, and if all he wanted to do was lie around the pool and not even bother to look for work, I'd have a problem with that. Yeah, so I don't know. I'm a little bit into my get off my lawn phase when it comes to stuff like I am the establishment now, let's face it. You know, granted, I'm the establishment who will listen to Kendrick Lamar and who does know pop culture, so that makes me seem a little cool and so forth. But when you come down to it, you know, I'm all for things like get off your ass and go to a job even if you don't like it. Or, you know, they don't pay you to have fun. They pay you to get these things accomplished so that the company can make a lot of money. And if you don't like it, you don't like your pay, don't bitch about it. Don't do it half-assed. Go find a better-paying job.
And that really is the trick. If you can do something that you halfway love, you've got a big part of the problem licked. You know, I've mentioned before, my dad was a furnace operator, and he would say, "Goody, I get to go to work today," because for as much as he would sweat and swear at the work that he did, he loved it. And when he had to stop doing it, it broke his heart.
Mm.
Because the working around the elements, all that power, all that heat, all the forces of nature, extracting a metal out of a rock, the danger, and you know, they paid him a fair wage to do it, and he felt like what he was doing was important, and it gave him satisfaction. Well, you got the wind column. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a furnace operator or a props master.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as long as you contribute something. Like the other day, a friend of mine who at work during lunch, he is a Muslim, and I am a nothing really. But he and I were talking about God and the purpose or if there is a purpose to life. And he was bringing up very valid points and saying, if I didn't think there were a purpose, a meaning to life, I don't know what I would do. I don't know how I could live with that life is just something that happens and then it doesn't. My feeling is, and this is certainly emphasized after having gone through the heart stuff, is, look, I'm just glad to be here. Whether I live for a year or 100 years, and whether the meaning is existence in and of itself, the fact is I get to be here, and whether I at the end of it all have accomplished stuff that has reaped a lot of money and awards and great things for my family and so forth, or if I'm just a guy who's if I'm just a shepherd out in the fields my entire life, I've still contributed something. I've contributed wool and meat and milk, or I've contributed movies that people will watch for the rest of movie's existence, or I've done work. You said he repaired furnaces or made furnaces, or no? What did he do again?
Operated them.
Operated. Everybody contributes something. We need it, And granted, you can get into discussions too about, you're contributing so that some people can be billionaires and you're just trying to scrape by. I get that too, and that's a side discussion. But just the act of showing up every day and doing something, and you can do it from your home. You can teach people from your home. You can do all kinds of things. Just do something. Don't sit around and wait for the world to come to you to buy your screenplay or to make you a supervisor. Because life doesn't work. They're not going to look for you. You got to look for them. And why am I lecturing you, Bob? You're not one of my children.
I don't know, but it works for me. It's pretty good advice. You're miles ahead of Polonius in Hamlet, as far as I'm concerned.
Damn it, Bob, do something. See, and like you're doing something. You're contributing something. And then, Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh contribute negative energy to the world. But that's a whole other thing, too.
Because how miserable would we be if we were all just happy?
I guess so. That's actually what a lot of Star Trek episodes were inevitably about, if you think of it. A lot of those episodes were about they land on a planet. The planet has the most beautiful people, including a lot of the most beautiful women who are all attracted to Kirk, and they can stay there. They're invited to stay and live out the rest of their lives. All they have to do is give up their free will and just exist among eternal happiness. And Kirk always spoils the party by saying, no, we have to go back and keep exploring planets because that is what gives us meaning. We have nothing to do here except be happy, and we as humans must do things beyond that while we're in this flesh and our hearts are pumping blood. And I guess he's right. I mean, it's also the thing of the Matrix too, right? Where would you rather be happy, but it's not real because it's actually all a dream? Or would you rather be real, but kind of miserable real? Who needs to get a phony baloney degree in philosophy? Well, actually, my son just got a degree in philosophy, and it's not going to
work. And it will probably work to his benefit somewhere along the way. One of the things that bothers me a lot is the de-emphasization of the arts and humanities in higher education. The University of Tulsa, among others, the University of Tulsa, among others, recently more or less eliminated its College of Arts and Sciences. Not going to teach languages anymore. They're not going to teach sociology. They're not going to teach anthropology. No. They're going to expand the business department.
Yeah, and you know, first of all, let me apologize for saying that philosophy is a phony baloney degree. It's not. It's not at all. It was a stupid, just shit coming out of my mouth thing. This is live, so any kind of nonsense could come out and that I could be embarrassed.
No apologies necessary. Fifteen years of saying stupid things from time to time, depending on who's measuring. No apologies necessary.
But there's this very popular meme that's going around on Facebook. I'm sure you've seen it, where it's like, you know, maybe what we should do is eliminate Algebra 2. And instead of that, we should have a class in how to balance your checkbook and how to pay off your credit cards. And you know, it gets a lot of likes. And the idea is not entirely terrible, except the first part. Why get rid of Algebra 2? There are people that are going to need that. Like engineers, for example, like scientists, a lot of really great things that have come about because
and it's it, and it's too. Not it's not an either or. We used to have classes in these things.
That's right.
In my senior year in high school, it was economics, but a lot of that stuff was taught also in a class that was largely taken once upon a time by women, called home economics.
That's right. Yeah, I think by the time I was in high school, they changed it to something like, I think it was like home care and domestic roles. And it was not only cooking and how to make a sponge cake, but we also did like the fake marriage, pretend you're married for a week thing, or here's a potato, pretend it's your baby for a week thing. You know, trying really hard to get across to the idea of me and my classmates, you know, maybe in don't want to get married immediately after graduation and pump out three kids by the
and the P.S. there's six. An and P.S. there's a grown-up world out there and it will eat you for lunch if you're not prepared.
That's right. And you know what, kids, marriage is hard. It takes a lot of work. You are going to argue sometimes and you gotta deal with that. But why am I, again, I'm preaching to the choir. I'm sure there's many choirs out there I'm preaching to. We all know this. We all should know this. But anyway, let me go back to the main thing, which is I hate seeing this thing of demeaning any bit of academic striving. You know, you could call it intellectualism, or you can just call it, you know, curiosity. You know, why is that something to be ashamed of? Why is it elitist to want to read a book? Why is it an unfair question to ask the president of the United States, hey, have you read any books lately? That should not be a gotcha question. That's just a question that I ask. I could ask Earl, my friend at work. You know, what have you been reading lately? I don't. Did you see that, by the way? That I guess it, yet another Trump interview. He was asked about what his favorite authors were, and he immediately said Tom Wolfe. And somebody said, well, what book is it that you read then? And he said, oh, I can't remember, but it's Tom Wolfe, and it's marvelous.
All of them. Well,
yeah, all of them was basically the answer. And of course, he had to slip in a thing of, well, The Art of the Deal is one that I love too, you know.
Well, that would have been because, you know, do you mean Tom Wolfe or Thomas Wolfe? Because can't you just see the nitwit Nero turning page after page after page of Look Homeward, Angel? You know,
I haven't read that one.
All
is that the one
900 pages of it or whatever it is?
That's why I didn't read it. That's a bit much for me.
No, you didn't have to read it as a theater major at WVU, but I did as an English major.
Haven't read Ulysses, have not read Moby Dick. But there's no reason that I can't. I mean, 900 pages. Yeah, but I've read three books of 300 pages, so just pretend it's all three books.
Yep, sure.
Why not?
Why not? Yeah. Hey, I got to ask you. I'm hearing the cough. Are you okay?
Yeah, my throat's dry. I've been working all day. I've been talking to people. We'll see what I sound like by the end of this. I might sound like I don't.
No, I mean, I worry. I want to make sure that, you know, you're okay.
I'm okay. I just get a little tired too. You know, we'll see. Am I gonna last till 9 o'clock, or am I gonna at some point beg off? Before I lose any kind of voice, let me just say too that, you know, like I guess it was probably 3 or 4 weeks ago that I had IM'd you one day on Facebook to say, Bob, can I be on the show tomorrow? I've got things on my mind. and you were like, yeah, you're welcome anytime. Thanks. And then I couldn't do it because I was, you know, I started this job and just starting a job, you know, it's a little, I got to get used to it, the commute. I would just come home exhausted, but I've got the energy now. But I'm not quite as, you know, what it was I was really upset, like a lot of us were, about the stuff going on regarding women's rights for their bodies, the abortion laws in Alabama and where else?
Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, Missouri, Georgia, Ohio, Mississippi. Yeah.
Right, but specifically at that time, the focus was on Alabama and Georgia. And I think, was it Michigan? But those were the two big ones. Alabama was the first to really get notice, I think. I mean, this has been going on all along, but for whatever reason, that week, that's all people were talking about, and rightfully so. And I was just frustrated as hell, Bob. I knew this was going on. It's still going on right now. And once again, I hit this feeling of helplessness. Like, and I was going to go on your show, to honest to God, and I still am, actually, to ask not only you, but any of your listeners, what do we do? What the hell do we do about this? And the thing is that, yeah, I mean, this is still going on. It's still terrible. And I, particular, as an individual, haven't really done that much to stop it. And, you know, I was thinking for a while, maybe the real thing to do is boycotts. Like, I do know that in Georgia, the film industry is a huge part of business now in Georgia. It rakes in billions of dollars.
Yeah, it's Yollywood.
It's Yollywood, right? And they do offer tax incentives that some of that money comes back, but on the other hand, or isn't taxed, I should say. But at the same time, it's making billions of dollars for the state of Georgia. So I was all hopped up for the idea of let's boycott Georgia, and specifically the film business there. And I wasn't doing that, honest to God, selfishly, like, hey, now it all gets to come up to New York. I honestly was like, you know what? I know it's going to hurt, but, you know, fuck it. It's got to hurt somebody. But I did hear back from some of my friends who are working down there, and they're like, yeah, it's easy for you to say. You know, if it happened to you, where maybe you could lose your house, maybe you wouldn't feel it. And it's like, you know, I get that. The fact is, I don't know the best answer, Bob. I don't know, what do we do about Alabama? What do we do about Flint, Michigan? What do we do about, you know, a crazy president? It's very easy to get that feeling of helplessness. It's very easy to get burned out. Honest to God, every day that I go to online, to CNN or some of the other news sites, the first question I ask myself is, what in the hell did he do now? That's what I, and I'm sure you do too. What,
yeah,
did he say?
And I think,
what
I think,
did he do? What's he want to do?
I think we are harmed to a certain extent, Dan, by our own narratives, because the great era of protest and change that came from protest is the Vietnam era and the civil rights struggle.
Right.
And particularly with the Vietnam protests, those happened because kids who were 16, turning 17, turning 18, young men, had skin in the game because their ass was gone unless somebody could get them a bullshit bone spurs diagnosis.
So
they were motivated to go into the streets.
Yeah.
In the civil rights struggle, it was, you know, 100 years after the Civil War, and it was as if the South had won.
Mm-hmm.
And so a strategy had to be developed to make progress against that. But we are not living in the same circumstances, so though, you know, some of those models may not work.
But why is it that in England, for example, when Trump goes to visit, hundreds of thousands can pour out in the street to protest his visit? You know, what's happening in Hong Kong right now? I mean, it's similar to what you're saying. Those people definitely have skin in the game because, you know, the Chinese government is saying, hey, we're going to just take away your rights. Sorry, too bad. You know, good luck with that. And they're taken to the streets. Whereas here, maybe it's the slow erosion of rights. Maybe it's that, hey, let's get rid of Roe v. Wade by going state by state and just knocking all the pins out until it just collapses on its own.
Can I be kind of a nattering nabob of negativity here?
Yes, Mr. Agnew.
Maybe we don't do this as good as we think we did. I was talking to someone earlier, and we were discussing what would happen, say, in France, if you had let's say a TV production network decided to fire everybody. They said, "You're fired." And then they came back and said, "You're all rehired under a different company. You're no longer a member of a union. You no longer have any benefits. And your vacation time and your comp time and all that crap is now gone. And take it or leave it." And the Frenchman who was responding to that in this story that was told me said that because that had happened in the United States. It had happened in New York City.
Uh-huh.
And the Frenchman said, "Well, that wouldn't happen in France, because everybody would be out in the streets protesting because they're a member of a union. And then the truck drivers would park their trucks in the middle of the interstates or in the middle of the highways. And then the teachers would go on strike. And then the airline mechanics would go on strike. And then the pilots would go on strike. And then the cops would go on strike." And so they would never even dare contemplate something like that. But one of the first things that happened historically in this country was that as soon as we had the obvious rising power of the union movement that was enabled, again, I was talking about FDR earlier, through the National Labor Relations Act, the Republicans got busy via a man named Robert Taft, a nasty, nasty Republican senator from Ohio.
Is he related to the Taft? Yeah, that same family, right.
To curtail the power of the union to call for people to withhold their labor pending agreement by the money, management, the capital, if you will. And so things like wildcat strikes and general strikes are, and you know, we walk around and you know, certain the right-wingers, you know, they walk around with their Lee Greenwood playing in their headphones, and tomorrow, and God bless the USA, right, and never realizing that they aren't anywhere near as free as they think they are. Because the only way to avoid having involuntary servitude is to have the absolute unquestioned power to withhold your labor.
That's right. We
do not have that in the United States, Dan Fisher. We simply do not have that. It's like, we have made such a fetishized word out of freedom that, like so many other words that get overworked, it loses its meaning. And so when we talk about, I'm free, well, look, and this goes back to last night's program, and I'm not going to rehash it. You know, we've got laws that say that there are certain things you can't say about a senator or a member of the House of Representatives or a governor or, God knows, a president. You can't say it, or the law enforcement establishment will come down on you like a ton of damn bricks, and they'll win, and you'll be gone. On the other hand, however, because we also fetishize this idea of free speech, work with me here. You have a group of preachers who are getting together this weekend in Orlando, Florida, at the anniversary of the Pulse nightclub massacre to celebrate the slaughter of the people who died there because they were gay.
Right.
And whose freedom extends to them standing in the pulpit calling for gay people to be executed as a matter of law.
Well, I still believe that is not America. That yes, there are not only preachers that feel this strongly, there are people, there are followers of those people who believe that strongly. I do believe that we are still not at that point in our nation's identity to think that the majority of people are willing to go that far, even if they're uneasy with the idea of homosexuality or transgender. Even if they don't want to see two men kiss in a movie or on the street, they don't want to kill them. Most people know that murder is, there is a commandment that addresses this issue, right, that Moses talked about long ago. But
But the problem, Dan, and I agree with you, there is not a majority of people who want that.
Right.
But this country, throughout its history, has never been moved by majorities. It has been
moved by the powerful.
No, it has been moved by noisy pluralities. There was nothing anywhere near a majority in support of prohibition. Mm-hmm. But there was a plurality that was organized enough to get the amendment run through Congress and approved by the states. And so, you know, we had the crime wave known as prohibition until FDR came along and got a sane Congress and got it and got it the hell repealed. There are other places where the majority was that hateful. I mean, we have to remember that white supremacy, as we know white supremacy as this, what we would hope would be an odious relic of the past. But the fact of the matter is, in the history of the United States, white supremacy was not only acceptable, it was the stated position of the governments of virtually every state in this union.
Oh yeah, manifest destiny.
And then we talk about the indigenous peoples and what was done to the Chinese immigrants in the 19th century on the West Coast. And the mistreatment of people from south of the Rio Grande and south. So my caution to you would be that we not seduce ourselves into thinking that a majority is what's necessary to rip this country apart. I think we've had ample evidence since January the 20th, 2017, if not before, that about a third of this country is enough to destroy the other two-thirds.
Yep. I mean, let us not forget, and let us always remind our Republican friends who try to tell us that most of America is for Trump. You know, the guy, 3 million more of us voted not for him than him in 2016. He both got very lucky, but he also had savvy enough people behind him to realize that you could game the electoral system, which Bush did against Gore, too.
Right.
You can game the electoral system so that you do not have to have a majority of votes in order to become president of the United States.
And we must remember that the Electoral College itself is an anachronistic remnant from our slavery past.
Yeah, and so what it does, I've complained about the electoral system for some time, not just because Trump won or even when Bush won. As a New Yorker, I really, you know, my vote doesn't count nearly as much as somebody from Iowa it's unbalanced that I don't, you know, I could not go to the polls for the presidential election. It really wouldn't matter. And the politicians know it really doesn't matter because my state is very likely going to go for the Democrat. And there are other states that are almost always going to go for the Republican. So what it comes down to is that the candidates go to only a certain number of states that are the purple states that could go either way. That's why, you know, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Virginia, those places you'll bump into a candidate.
It begins to smell a little bit like a rigged game after a while, doesn't it?
I would say that. I mean, you're going to run into somebody eating a fried corn dog or a fried Twinkie, you know, every freaking day if you live in those states.
Why should someone in Montana, no offense to our friends in Montana,
my son's middle name is Montana, but that's another story.
Cool.
But anyway,
why should a person in Montana have 1,000 times or more the amount of representation in the United States Senate than somebody in California or New York?
Yeah, I mean, even
because that's the reality.
Even the electoral map, which I understand Trump has hanging up on his office, and he will give out as prizes to people who come visit him. He'll give them a framed copy of the electoral map showing his massive victory because he loves looking at the picture, right? Where there's so much red and there's not as much blue on that map as there is red. So that shows that America loves him. Except that, you know, the red is representing like a state like Colorado, where so much of that land itself, there are no people on it. People don't live there. It's just land. Or in Texas, it's a humongous state, and it's a wonderful state. I just watched HUD the other day. But it, per capita, it just doesn't make sense that those people get much more power value, bang for their buck, whatever, with their vote than I do.
Sure,
it's not fair.
You and everybody in Massachusetts, everybody in New York, everybody in California, Washington, Oregon, several subsidize Alabama, Mississippi.
And
Alabama and Mississippi couldn't build a they couldn't build a gravel road without you.
Because of the taxes that my state and people of my income are putting into the whole system, and my my income is basically middle class. In my case, I guess a little more than average middle class income. But on the other hand, the people that you hit a certain level and then suddenly you're not paying at all.
And so to loop back to what you were saying about being upset about the assault on women's autonomy in Alabama and Ohio, but in Alabama in particular, the bottom line is that you, Dan Fisher, in New York, have subsidized that.
More than,
And I don't, I mean, that's the get out the Oxford English Dictionary with the magnifying glass and look up galling. That's it. And that's, that's why one of the watchwords here for this little program is that in the United States of America, democracy has always been far more aspirational than operational. It is something we talk about. It's something we dream of. It's something we work toward. But over time, it has never been anything that we were particularly good at.
No, I mean, in certain ways, it's as pie in the sky as the idea of socialism is, that we are all masters of our own individual fates. So we're a collective, and there are going to be people that figure out how to manipulate the collective for their individual wants. I can't say needs, their individual wants. I'm always aware of time. I do want the last half hour of the show to be goofy and funny.
Okay,
so
good.
Already it's 8 o'clock. So it's like whatever big stuff, important, change the world stuff you and I are going to talk about, I want it to be like in the next half hour.
Okay, and let me send out a couple of thank yous because people support the program along the way, and I like to thank them when it happens.
Oh God, yeah.
Thank you to Kat in Ohio, and thank you very kindly to Brian. That puts us. Just $25 away from meeting Chris's challenge, which doubles your money. So that's wonderful. Thank you very kindly. And then past that, if we can just raise another $100, it'll be awesome.
$100 is nothing, folks. Come on, $100. That's what? That's how many cups of Starbucks? That's 20 cups of Starbucks.
Well, it's like I try to boil that sort of stuff down. For somebody who subscribes to keep the horn on the air for $10 a month. It works out to not quite half of a McDonald's hash brown patty per day.
And when you have a hash brown patty from McDonald's, tell me the truth. When you walk away from that meal, are you really happy? Do you really feel you've gotten anything out of it?
In particular, with regard to the hash brown patties, I always feel worse. They make me feel terrible.
Yeah, they only give you shame. Whatever you're feeling while you're shoving them into your pie hole, you come away feeling like you wasted your money and you're ashamed. Now, on the other hand, you take that money, you give it to Bob Kincaid's show. I'm not even saying give to Bob Kincaid. You give it to keep the show going. This is 3 hours. You like how I'm joining in the pitch here? I feel like I need a cane and a straw hat. Got trouble in River City. But no, if you contribute to the Bob Kincaid show on the horn, you are look what you're getting for 3 hours. Once a month, you got this goofball that comes in and tells you trivia about the Academy Awards, and we talk about movies and TV, and I try to get you to donate your organs after you're dead. You get all of that, and bamboo wind chimes.
And bamboo wind chimes, yes. I've been working on a deal, but Jim Baker has the market cornered. I can't get my hands on any bucket pudding nowhere to hustle. But then again, that stuff's slime, so it probably makes you feel...
I do not know of this buck of pudding of which you speak.
Oh, Jim Baker is working the end times apocryph hustle.
Oh, that was and they so teach he that and, in schools too.
And so he pushes this, and I think it can survive a nuclear blast, All you have to do is have clean water to add to it, and you've got buckets and buckets of pudding and macaroni and cheese, and it's just nasty.
I see.
And it only costs you $3,000 a year.
And the pudding, let's face it, powdered pudding that you just add water, there's got to be something not right there. It's got to be like ground up horse hooves or something.
Yeah, right, it's not good stuff, folks. You know, as I've said before, the simple phrase bucket pudding just sounds filthy.
Listen, I love pudding, but if the apocalypse comes, right, and I'm told either you can go out front and face the four horsemen, and they're probably going to melt your face off like it's the end of Indiana Jones, or you can go down in this basement and eat pudding for the next 20 years, but it's Jim Baker brand pudding and not the good stuff, I'm going to just say, hey, come here, Gabriel.
Yeah, come here, Trigger. Yeah.
Do your damage.
Yep. And behold, behold, a pale horse and butterscotch bucket pudding rode with him.
I know that from Johnny Cash, but I don't know other than that where that saying comes
from. Yeah, it comes from Revelations.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
But Johnny Cash has that before a song called When the Man Comes Around.
Yeah, which is an awesome, those three albums were, wow. Yeah.
Yes.
I actually listened to those quite a bit.
Yes, but so it comes back around for me. You know, I'm constantly both, you know, worrying about this stuff and berating myself for not doing enough and then not doing enough. And I realize it's kind of similar to what I have experienced in my life, and maybe all of us have, where we look in the mirror, we realize we're getting fat, and we say, by God, I gotta lose some weight. It's not that hard if I just really commit to it, right? All I need to do is maybe exercise a little, just a little bit, you know, go out for a walk, don't eat the ice cream every night, you know, all that stuff. And I got to lose some weight. And you start out that first week, the first 2 weeks, you're doing good, drop a few. And then some point or other, you get the Coke, not the Diet Coke, you drink the regular Coke, and you put, you know, you go to McDonald's and you've given up and you stop doing the walk. We all do this, right? We all have those moments and we all fail our own standards. And so what I propose tonight for myself and for the world, I want this to go viral, is we need a national program of political fitness. I came up with that all on my own, political fitness. Here's what it is. It's just like physical fitness, only it's how do we become stronger and more politically active people. And I came up with levels. Like,
okay.
there's the mild level, right? Which is like those yoga tapes or the yoga videos you watch on YouTube, which are meant for old people or whatever. But you watch them because you try to do them because that's all you can do, is like grandma level yoga, no matter what your age. So this is mild level political fitness. Basically, it's pretty much anything you can do from your house. You read online articles. You try to bring your own awareness up. You post stuff when you read it and you like it. But you also can do things out of the house. Once every 2 years or every 4 years, you go out and you vote and you get a sticker. I mean, I like that too, that nowadays when you vote, you don't just get that feeling of pride that you help maybe accomplish something. You get a sticker. Like you went to the barber.
Beats the hell out of getting your thumb turned purple.
Listen, but on the other hand, if that's what makes people vote, let's keep giving out stickers. Let's give lollipops. Why not? If that's what it takes, let's keep doing that. But here's some more examples of mild political fitness levels. Donating to some degree, you know, $20 to the ACLU or $10 to the Horn with Bob Kincaid. Passive boycotting, where you just say, you know what, I'm not going to shop at Walmart, but I am going to go down to I'm going to go to Target, which is probably not much better, but it's a little better. You put a bumper sticker on, anything like that. That's all low-level political fitness. You're doing something.
Can I add something to low-level political fitness?
Sure, there's lots of examples. What are yours?
Read the damn Constitution.
Read the damn Constitution. It's funny you say that. We're going to bring that up at the end of the show. You don't know this yet, Bob, but I got something planned for us that's constitutionally connected.
Oh dear.
So I'm glad read. Don't just claim and listen, it's harder. Reading the Constitution is like reading Shakespeare. You can't do it all at once.
But it ain't near as long.
it's not as long, but there are tricky words, and literacy levels just continue to plummet. But yes, I think you're right. Give it a try. See how far you can get. And if you don't get that far, think of it like a 900-page book. Think of it like Thomas Wolfe or Ulysses. Just read what you can, mark your place, come back to it tomorrow, and keep doing that till you get to the end. That's a good thing.
Well, but yeah, and, you know, it's broken up into sections. You can start with the preamble.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
that's
the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and to contribute. Oh, I'm blanking because I got a little nervous.
You're doing great.
And secure the blessings of liberty.
And then, you know, the next
posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution. See, I can only do it if I sing at Schoolhouse Rock.
I understand. Yes. Look, those little mnemonics help.
Oh, sure.
And so the next day, day one, you read the preamble. Day two, you read Article One.
And folks, I'm not just preaching to you like I've got this all figured out and I'm going to show you the way. No, I'm preaching to myself because I have high ideals, but a lot of the time I am a political lazy ass. Hi, I'm Dan Fisher, and I'm a political lazy ass. Hi, Dan. So these are things that I do. I do pretty much a lot of my activism has come within my own house. I read a lot. I think a lot. I'm concerned a lot. Once a month, I shoehorn my way into the horn. You know, I have black friends. I have LGBT friends. I do have trans friends. But on the other hand, you know, how often do I get together with them? How often do I not white-splain or mansplain or straight-splain to them? How often do I just ask them things and talk to them and try to learn from them? Not enough, I don't think. We're non-Christian friends. You know, my friend Earl is a Muslim. And so he's the first, honestly, the first Muslim I've had a close relationship with in my life, a real friendship. In all of my 55 years, I've had Muslim neighbors. I've said hi to them, but I've known nothing about them. I've asked nothing from them to contribute to my consciousness. And I have black friends that say, you know what, it's not my job to teach you. Yeah, that's true. It's not your job to teach me how to be more aware. But on the other hand, it would sure help me out a lot if you did. Do you mind? You know, if I ask you a stupid racial question, yeah, you can call me on it. But on the other hand, do you mind teaching me? Do you mind trying? Because I've got 55 years of shit in my head to clean up. Things that are just wrong. Things I was told as a kid that turned out not to be true are still in there. So I need a little help. And if you're gay and I ask you a stupid gay question, please forgive me. But just try to help me understand it and understand you.
We would go further down the road we seek to travel if we would assume good faith on the part of each other. And I mean that that may sound simple, but it is what I
is that a quote or did you just say that?
No, that's me.
Holy shit, that's good.
And it's you know, I've got this standing rule here. I don't have to invoke it very often. We don't allow right wingers on this program because I know how they behave. And I know I'm stereotyping, but you know, they got Alex Jones, they got all of it. Go hang out with them because they do not bring good faith to the discussion. And so what I've tried to do here, Dan, is to create a space in which people of goodwill who are willing to presume good faith on the part of the rest of the community can work out issues, can work out ideas, can teach each other.
That's right. It's not about owning, even for us good old liberals here. Remember this, it's not about owning. It's not about do you feel good about yourself because you feel you've won an argument. What it really is about is making real change. And that can be in very small increments. That can be locally. You don't have to wipe out President Trump single-handedly. There are a lot of bad guys in the world besides President Trump, a lot of them. And
a lot of our problems and a lot of our problems did not begin on January the 20th, 2017. And it is so hard, Dan, even for me, to realize that because it's up in front of your face and he's up in front of your face. I was thinking as I was driving, because that happens a lot when I drive long distances. I can say someone enigmatically that if one day you were to open a newspaper or open your interweb tubes and see a story about a mid-50s, really pale white guy having been arrested dancing naked deliriously in his yard, it'll probably be me, and it will mean that one particular thing has happened in this country. And I can't say what that thing is. But
I'm not following you actually on that one. I'm trying.
Well, you don't have to. I think a lot of members of the community probably have a pretty good idea. There's an old joke about a guy who stops at the newsstand. Let's say it's in New York City. He stops at a newsstand every morning. He pays for a newspaper. He picks the newspaper up. He folds it open so he's got the whole paper in front of him. He scans the front page, sets the newspaper down, and goes on his way. He does this morning after morning after morning. And finally, the vendor looks at him and says, "Hey, buddy, you pay for a newspaper every day, but you never take the paper." The guy says, "Well, you know, I don't want to be unfair to you and just read the paper for free. And I'm just looking to see trying to check and see if somebody's died." He goes, "Yeah, but you never even opened to the obituaries." He says, "Nah, this son of a bitch is going to be on the front page." Boom, boom.
That's good. That's good. That's good. I get it. So yeah, I think I know the source of your dancing and so forth.
Right.
Yeah.
But again, so many of our problems go back to Ronald Reagan. I mean, there are certain of our problems that go back to the shellacking that Barry Goldwater took in 1964, after which the Republicans swore never again. And they began to build an infrastructure, and they built it inexorably through the 60s. And in the 70s, you get the Powell Doctrine, written by Lewis Powell, who went on to be rewarded for his work with a seat on the Supreme Court of the United States. And the Powell Doctrine commands corporate America to start pouring copious amounts of tax-deductible cash into right-wing think tanks that would transform this country in ways that we had never seen, and which results in where we are in 2019.
Well, but you're also talking about within our lifetime. And then, you know, my daughter, by the way, is a history major. I think she specializes in Asian history of the 3rd century. But on the other hand, this goes way, 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 way back before even America. So, I mean, you could go back to the fact that this country is founded on the murder of millions of Native Americans. And we just said, "Hey, we want that land."
And the death and the disaster of the Middle Passage. And the millions of man hours and woman hours of labor stolen, for which there has never to this day been a goddamn dime of recompense.
Yeah, but you know, if you reference Stanley Kubrick's 2001, you really get the idea. It's the first time somebody figured out that a bone could be used as a weapon. Suddenly, the guy who has the biggest, best weapon, or the country has the... Gets the land, gets the women, gets everything.
It's macro to micro. Probably the biggest mistake humanity ever made was becoming sedentary and engaging in agriculture. We had far more leisure time as hunter gatherers, and probably lived better. I mean, it's a relative scale. I mean, they didn't have iPhones, but you know, then again, they didn't have a lot of the bad things we have. So
well,
I mean, it's macro versus micro.
Mm-hmm.
But the changing, because all that Barry Goldwater stuff forward is a reaction to the policies of FDR and the New Deal, like what I was talking about with Robert Taft in the '50s. It was a reaction of the moneyed class against the notion that working people in this country were getting far too damned uppity and might at some point in time make the Republicans 0.001% less rich.
And that goes entirely against what capitalism should be about. Capitalism is the idea that if you should be, I was told as a kid, that if you work hard and you educate yourself and you find something that you're passionate about and you're innovative, you'll at least, at the very least, be able to provide well enough for your family. And you know, we all chip in and we all create this great country and we all reap the rewards. And, you know, we all know how that's gone now.
Well, and that was probably a bit of a fib. Although Adam Smith, Adam Smith was a noted progressive thinker of his era. He was not a conservative by any stretch of the imagination. He said the progressive state is the natural state of the advancement of humanity, Adam Smith did. The capitalism that he talked about in The Wealth of Nations, which he considered to be one of his lesser works, is as far from the capitalism of today as we are from Canis Major, the dog star, okay? His capitalism was a matter of shared risk and shared reward. Not shared equally, but shared nonetheless.
It should be. We all contribute to a product. We should all reap something.
But in Ayn Rand's vision of anarcho-capitalism, which is where we are now,
fucking Rand.
Milton Friedman and the Chicago School and all of that evil crap, the risks are all borne by the working class, and the rewards are all taken by the ownership class. So when a great big corporation of America goes belly up, the corporate class goes into bankruptcy court and says, but we need to keep being rich. And the best way we can keep being rich is if you liquidate those working people's pensions and give it to us. And the bankruptcy court says, well, that's what the law says I have to do, so granted.
Yep. Hey, I'm going to hijack this back to me because, again, I keep my eye on the clock. And there are some things I want to...
We didn't get to medium, and we certainly didn't get to spicy.
Well, the next level is medium because I couldn't come up with a funnier name than that. So this is medium level political fitness. Like, let's say you've gotten it down. So you do read stuff. You are informed. You do go to an occasional maybe community meeting. You do sign petitions to be sent to Congress people, like online. Well, the medium is the next step where you actually start showing up to things. You go on community marches. You decide I'm not going to always buy from the big national brands. I'm going to buy local. I am going to join aggressive boycotting board. Like, if I find out that a certain company is doing something, I try to be part of a national boycotting movement and encourage my friends to do also. And then also it's not just volunteering once a year, twice a year. That's medium level where you actually show up to something. That's where I'm going with all this. It's one thing to talk, that's another to show up. And so there are people that, you know, this, I'd say I'm halfway between mild and medium. I have gone on the occasional community march for gun safety and for women's issues, women's rights, women's autonomy, as you well put it. A lot of this is because I have a feminist daughter and a feminist wife who continually remind me that it ain't enough just to sympathize. You got to show up. You got to put boots on the ground. And God bless them for that, to get me off my ass. And I show up. And you know what? A local news camera will be there. And so that night on the news for 15 to 30 seconds, there's a bunch of us chanting something or other. And it just makes people aware, hey, somebody's thinking about this. Somebody cares. Now, it's not hundreds of thousands in the streets of France or Hong Kong, but it's something. And it's better, again, than nothing. Everything is good. Like, do you remember, I don't know how many years ago it was, where the floods in Louisiana, New Orleans?
Katrina.
And Sean Penn went down there and to help out. And there was a shot of Sean Penn in a boat. And he's like paddling a rowboat all by himself. He's paddling a rowboat around to these rooftops, and he's helping people get in the boat. And of course, you know, the Fox News and so forth is like, oh, look at him. He's just making a photo opportunity. It's like, I don't care if it's a photo opportunity, even if it is promoting his next movie. The fact is, he's in a boat and you're not.
He's doing something and you're not.
Somebody got out of their house to dry land because Sean Penn was in a fucking rowboat and wanted his picture taken. And whatever, and I know, for all I know, he didn't think of his latest movie or anything at all. for all I know, it's probably more likely that he was sincere in his attempts, that he was like, I want to do something. I'm a rich guy. I can go wherever I want, and I can.
And you know what?
I help people, and that's what he did.
I, in my right, can get a little bit bitter about that. I was talking about Jon Stewart earlier this evening, and I wasn't trying to take anything away from Jon Stewart. But, you know, you've got as many people as died on 9/11 die every 3 years in West Virginia because of mountaintop removal. But, you know, Jon Stewart wasn't there to talk about that. I understand that.
It's not an either-or proposition.
It's not a zero-sum game. The other day I was watching Morning Joe, and they had Carol King. I feel the earth move on. And she was there because she has transformed herself into a... she's transformed herself into an activist for the wild places of the West and environmental preservationism, conservation, as it were. And again, please forgive me if this comes across bitter or cynical, but it's a fact. We've been working a bill that would save literally thousands of lives in central Appalachia, and I'm going to be working on it next week too. And if only we had somebody that was deemed to be important enough and starfuckable enough, you know, because that's a term of art, starfucking. If we had who would talk about the AIC Act, and you know, maybe Mika and Joe would then take interest in all the dead little hillbillies and the sick hillbillies. But we don't. But we don't have a super celebrity to stand out there. All we've got is people who know the data, who know what's going on, and can talk about it, but, you know, good luck getting on Morning Joe.
Well, but this is what I do know about celebrities, because I work among celebrities, is all of them, even the ones that you've barely heard of, or I've barely heard of, they all are constantly being asked to lend their name and their faces to good causes. And most of the ones I know, honest to God, do put in their time. The cast of Law & Order, when I was there, if my wife is always involved with health advocacy issues, education or women's breast cancer issues, things like that. When I was at Law & Order, all I had to ask, you know, like Sam Waterston or a Peyton Murkison is, you know, we're going to. I can tell you the answer to this dilemma in terms of getting. You do need celebrity because celebrities lights shine on celebrities,
and we have had them from time to time. We just don't have them now.
Well, but what you need to get is a West Virginia celebrity, somebody who is a movie star or a musician or an athlete that came from that state and will in interviews talk about their West Virginia pride and reminisce about the good old days. Call them on it. Say okay. Why don't you come down here and help us defend this? And, you know, they may go, oh, I don't do politics. It's like, well, this isn't politics. This is human life.
Well, yeah, in the case of West Virginia and Central Appalachia generally, it's really, and I'm not making excuses, it's difficult to do that because it is seen as being, what we're doing is seen as being anti-coal.
Which is,
you know, there's, in West Virginia, there's, spitting on Jesus, and then there's saying something about coal. Saying something bad about coal is only slightly less evil than spitting on Jesus.
Well, I'm going to speculate on a particular celebrity, and I might be completely unfair in my speculation, but I'm just going to go there, which is, who's one of the most famous celebrities from West Virginia who's out there and working right now? To me, it's Brad Paisley. I see him on Nationwide commercials.
Yeah, he took a powder on it.
Right. I'm sure he would, because he plays country music.
Right.
His audience is very often conservative, and he doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't want to offend his audience and therefore perhaps, you know, ruin his good thing going. He likes making money by selling lots of music and going on concert tours, and he doesn't want people to boo him. I get that. Look what the Dixie Chicks went through just for the one thing they said on quote-unquote foreign soil, which pales in comparison to anything our president has said, certainly on foreign soil. But that's another topic. I don't know. Let me put some, you know what? let me put some thought into it.
Yeah, you know, you were saying who's working right now. You know who's got deep roots in West Virginia?
Jennifer Garner, I know, but who else?
Gaga.
Gaga does?
Yeah.
In what way? She's from there?
Her grandma was a Chi Omega at West Virginia University.
Oh, you know what? I think I remember something like that.
And she spent many a happy hour, and in fact, in the dark time of her life, whatever, when she was trying to figure it, she came running back to Granny and stayed in West Virginia for a while.
Well, all I can tell you this, Bob, before we get to the next levels of political fitness, I will, honest to God, try to think of any celebrities that might have not only West Virginia connections, but ecological connections.
Jennifer Lawrence is a Kentucky girl.
I've worked with her. I'm not palsy wowsy with her, but I don't know. Let me just see if I can connect anybody. I mean, even if it's like a D-level star, you know, somebody is better than nobody. You're going to need to get real awareness on this. You're going to need celebrity. You're going to need a little bit of PR that sweet PR that brings to you. It's just the world we live in. You know, it's a world in which, you know, you can post a photo, a video of a cat doing, you know, eating avocado, and suddenly you're an influencer.
In the past, we've had excellent help from Daryl Hannah. She came down here. She came down and got arrested once.
Oh, I remember reading about that.
And Kathy Matea has lent her
another West Virginia
her name. Woody Harrelson has been helpful
Woody's
in the distant past.
Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe you need a PR person or something like that. I mean, I know you've got no money for such things, but that's a problem. I don't know. Let me see if I can help in any way, because I want to reach medium level political fitness here.
Okay. Yeah, we've got, and we still got Spicy too.
My next one is actually Ripped. You know, because again, fitness. I'm going for
Yes. Mild, medium, and Ripped.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the first level shouldn't be mild. It should be like, you know, not weakling, because I don't mean it. Weakling is when you do nothing. And mild is when you kind of do things like post something you feel strongly about.
Couch
on Facebook.
Potato?
It could be. But Ripped. Ripped is like when you go down to Washington for, you know, the National March on the Monument. Ripped is you only buy non-corporate brands. You know, you'll go out of your way to not shop at even Whole Foods, because they're owned by Amazon. And you'll be a strong part of a boycott or a strike. You'll be on the front lines, and you'll be willing to miss work, or you'll be willing to get jailed. You know, that's the big stuff. You know, think a second. You know, I worked on a movie called Mississippi Burning a long time ago. And you think a second of what these people did in the Freedom Summer. There were people, but not all students and not all white people, got on buses from New York, Massachusetts, all over the United States. They got on buses. They came down to Mississippi in the summer of 1964, and they helped black Mississippians and Alabamans to register to vote. And the whole time they were being very much pushed back against. But now the real bravery is not those white people on buses, but that's a huge level of commitment. The real bravery are the people that live there, because eventually, if they signed up to vote and the white kids went back on their buses to go back home, those people were still living there and had to suffer the consequences. And I know there was a lot of suffering for daring to do what they were legally and constitutionally entitled to do, which is to register to vote and to vote. And who would have thought that in 2016 and 2019 we'd still be facing the issue of, do black people get to vote, yes or no? But that's a whole other thing with 27 minutes left in our thing. So my point is, there's just varying levels of which how you can get involved. But the thing is, I think is to think of it like exercise, where you go and you say, okay, I'm just going to walk around my block a couple of times. That's better than watching TV. So don't feel terrible that that's all you do. Get started with that. And again, I'm not preaching to you, and I'm not preaching to your audience. I'm preaching to myself. It's as if I'm looking in the mirror. I'm saying, okay, it's not, don't feel too bad, Dan Fisher, that all you do are write paragraphs or go on podcasts or don't go to Walgreens. That's, or Walmart. That's not bad. That's not bad. Do that. Now let's see if we can add 10 pounds to the weights, and let's see if you can.
Right, because that's the important part of the process. If you engage on whatever we're calling level one, it is not unthinkable that you will wind up ripped.
Yeah. Well, there's ripped, and then there's finally beast mode. And I don't recommend this for most people. I mean, beast mode is like when you are willing to get arrested, especially if you're a person of color. Getting arrested could kill you. I don't have to tell any listeners out there who are people of color this is true. We're going on hunger strikes. You know, anything Martin Luther King would do or Gandhi would do, that's beast mode. And not only most of us can't do that, we shouldn't do it. That's for the experts. That's for the people who get ripped and that's nothing to them. But the main point again is simply, let's start with something. Don't be satisfied that you went and saw a movie that tells you that racism is bad. Do something. Don't just have a black best friend. Go find out more about Black Lives Matter. You know, or it's up to me now.
Or learn the history.
I've never read the Quran. I've never tried reading the Quran. I fully believe that Muslims are entitled to the same religious liberties that I, if I were Christian, would have, or my wife who's Jewish would have. You know, but I've not read the Quran. I should do that, you know, or at least start out mild. You know, I don't have to read the whole damn thing. Maybe read an online article to find out what are the 10 things that the Quran really says, and then go into it little by little, like a Cliff's Notes version. But eventually, I should, if I'm going to have these feelings about things, I should learn more about these people. And if I'm going to be friends with Earl, I should be more respectful of him to actually see what he believes. And for all I know, I will think that it makes a lot of sense. And that might, oh, you're going to turn Muslim. Oh, that's scary. Maybe it's not as scary as we all come to believe. Maybe socialism, democratic or otherwise, isn't so as horrible as we've come to believe. Maybe if I just keep learning more about Bernie, maybe I will be. I don't want to become one of those Bernie bros, because I find Bernie bros just personally obnoxious and self-righteous and hard to be in a room with for 5 minutes. That's just me. Maybe I'm wrong in being judgmental and I'm an asshole. But I want to just keep learning and building and growing. And besides the learning and growing part, I need to be more active. I work 5 days a week. I come home tired. It's true. There are Saturdays. There are Sundays. What's going on out there? What are people doing in my neighborhood? Where can I drive within an hour's range and be able to do something that actually is something? It's not just posting a something on Facebook. Let's go beyond that. Let's all of us. Hey, let's do it. But me, Dan Fisher, I gotta do more than talk. I gotta do. You know, let's make the verbs more active verbs that we do if we really believe this stuff. Not only strike for my union if my union is ever threatened. Let me see who else is picketing out there. Maybe I'll join the grocers sometime at my local grocery store. I think they should have a fair wage. If I believe that, why don't I stand on a corner with them for a couple hours on a Saturday? What harm does it do me? Not much. I think everybody should have a union card, not just in my craft. I think every occupation. And look what's happening to the teachers in West Virginia, by the way. I'm sure you've covered that. I mean, they're doing more, you know, they're really getting active. And I think a lot of people, a lot of teachers who might have been MAGAs in 2 years ago, I think they're coming around a little bit, because the national right to work laws and what just happened 2 weekends ago with the legislature, you know, trying to create laws that basically.
Well, one hopes they're learning. There was maybe a little movement, but as far as that, it certainly didn't manifest after, you know, the 55 Strong movement happened before the November 2018 elections. And we still have a Republican majority in both houses.
But I think, yes. But then that Republican majority just recently passed laws saying, hey, you don't get to strike. You are not allowed to. Or at least I think I don't know if they passed it or they've introduced it.
They're trying. They're trying.
They're trying like hell. And you can't tell me that at least some of those red state-leaning type teachers in West Virginia aren't paying attention and going, wait a minute, I may not care how this affects other people, but I sure as hell care how it affects me. Because we are very often innately selfish people, selfish beings. So if it affects them enough, maybe minds can be changed a little bit. And if you can think selfishly, you can start to think outside of yourself. I mean, I do believe in the one big union thing. I do feel a kinship with coal miners as much as I feel a kinship with people who bag groceries and people who certainly, you know, I'm going to my union's meeting next weekend on the
yeah,
Sunday.
Yeah, that's the man who essentially founded this radio network is one of the strongest union people I've ever known. And he said, you know, just getting people to show up for the meetings, for the union meetings, was a monumental hurdle. But once you got that going, you had a fighting chance. Just got a note from Lady B, and then we will move on to the fun, frivolous, and silly portion of the program.
Yes.
Lady B writes, maybe famous people don't want to be reminded where they come from. Also, like Dan says, too many people will ask them for money. And if you're poor and originally from Ohio or Kentucky or West Virginia, maybe you don't want to acknowledge that. So they save the whales and looky, they save the Amazon rainforest because whales don't buy records. Yeah, we need a face to go with the cause. But there's a reason why they left, I guess. It's sad. I don't know what the answer is without picking on them. But they can and should always help on a national level. As a lower income person, I'm a slave to my corporate masters. I also work in an at-will employment state. If I don't go to work, I could lose my home, period. But someday, Bob, I know I'll have to march. And that will be the day when you'll know the shit has really hit the fan. Let's hope it don't get that bad.
Well put, strongly put, I agree with most of what you say, Lady B. The one thing I will kind of give some maybe context to is that, you know, celebrities, at least the ones, I think I'm qualified to have an okay opinion on celebrity as a way of life. Not that I am one, but I'm around a lot of them, and I know some of them as more intimately than others. But celebrities cannot be spoken of as if they were an autonomous unit. Celebrities are individuals, and some individuals are good and almost saintly. Some are assholes. Most are in between, where they mean to do good, they don't do good. Or they'd like to do good, but they got a movie coming out that they got to promote. You know, everybody looks out for themselves principally, but the trick is, you know, you don't have to give up everything. You don't have to be Gandhi, but you do have to give a little more maybe than you're willing to give. I find that most celebrities are willing to give something because they are aware of their power and they are aware of where they come from. Sometimes they exploit that to sell things. Again, you'll have somebody come on who maybe spent, you know, a year of their life when they were a small child in West Virginia, and they go on to promote a movie, and suddenly they're aw shucks and I remember being on the porch kind of stuff. When the fact is they've lived outside of Boston for most of their lives, that kind of stuff. So there's all kinds of, you don't go to celebrity school to learn how to be a celebrity. It just comes, it happens sometimes unexpectedly. And it takes time to get used to.
And then, you know, sooner or later, as happens to all of us, there comes a moment when one finds out what kind of character one brought to the celebrity as opposed to what kind of character celebrity imposed upon one, because we're all still pretty much the same people.
Yeah, and the band, you know, The Clash that I was referencing at the top of the show and during this podcast I was listening to called Stay Free. You know, you see it happen with The Clash. They started out with their music, especially like their first album was really hardcore punk. It was like the Sex Pistols. And then they started stretching out musically, but all throughout the time they, in the early years through London Calling, what they were trying to do was be the only band that matters. They were trying to use their music to spread a message and to create real action. Their song Clampdown, you know, they say, it starts out, what are we going to do now? That's the first line of that song. What are we going to do now? And all throughout, they're talking about being at the barricades and taking action. But what happened, why The Clash inevitably broke up, is that they sucked at managing their own money. They were always broke. They suddenly made an album called Combat Rock with a couple of hit singles, Rock the Casbah. They suddenly had money, and they didn't know how to handle it. Suddenly, they weren't making songs. They didn't care so much about spreading the message. And they got to infighting about money and who gets the creative power and who doesn't, who gets the credit, who doesn't. And they broke up because it's like a wild horse. You just got to try to hang on to and keep hold of the reins. And some are really good at it and some are not. But, you know, even the most enlightened, like The Clash, who are basically Marxists with guitars, they couldn't hold on forever. They got into cocaine and heroin and the big entourages and the big buses, just like everybody gets to at some point, because they can. Why does a dog lick his genitalia?
Because he can.
Yeah. And if you were there, you might too.
And if you could do that, you'd never leave home. Right. Yeah, I know the rest of the joke. Absolutely. All right. Fun stuff.
Fun stuff. Okay. How do you want to do this now? The last time I had a whole lot of questions and...
last time I was right. Picking numbers.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to do... How about do the same? Okay. And we'll see how much time we have, depending on how long we kibitz on things.
Okay.
I want to save the last 5 minutes for a game show type thing.
Okay.
But right now, this is free form. So pick a number between 1 and 23.
19.
Hey, 19. That is... What is... Oh, you should... You posted about this week. What, Bob, is your favorite flavor of ice cream?
Orange.
Boy, we've gone from the sublime to the trivial like that.
But that's the way it's supposed to work. Orange pineapple. Yeah. Orange pineapple from Trowbridge's on North Court Street in Florence, Alabama.
Did you folks see his photo? Wasn't that the most humongous two scoops of ice cream you've ever seen in your
life?
That
was one.
That was one?
Yeah.
That was each one was the size of like an elephant's testicle.
That was like $1.25.
Oh, my God. That's Alabama?
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much to hate about Alabama, but you got to love their...
No, but there's so much to love, too, and that's what makes it such a complex relationship.
Lately, I'm going to make everything about me, of course, too, or at least I'm going to respond back. Once you give me a simple answer, I'm going to go into my answer as well. For the moment, I'm still... I don't like Jerry Garcia or the Grateful Dead, but I love Cherry Garcia, the ice cream. That's just me.
Well, you'll get hate mail over what you said first. But, yeah, I like it, too. But as I've gotten older, I've developed an appreciation for simpler flavors. I mean, the Häagen-Dazs, just plain old vanilla ice cream.
Mm.
You know, it's and there's no guar gum or carabine gum or carrageenan. It's cream and milk and sugar.
Yep.
And
no,
vanilla.
A lot of times after a big, big, hefty meal of some sort or another, and it's like, do we want dessert? And it's like, I know I can't really fit anything down there. And I know it's stupid to ingest 10,000 calories and then lop on another 1,000. But I somehow feel like vanilla is okay. Like, and so I'll ask for like a scoop of vanilla ice cream in a dish. That just feels like pleasant
enough. Yeah, well, and see, Häagen-Dazs makes those little single serve cups that come with their own spoon.
Yeah.
I can always make things more complicated because I didn't tell you about this, but we were talking about this a few months back. Smucker's came out with some different flavors of jam, and one of them was strawberry jalapeno. And just to put a little bit of that on Häagen-Dazs vanilla is exquisite.
That's good. Let me ask you a counter question then. Have you ever had a flavor of ice cream that you just didn't like? Like there was a song called Everyone Loves Ice Cream that used to do on Sesame Street. But is there an ice cream that you don't like?
And maybe it was the manufacturer, but there was a flavor of black. There was a brand of black walnut ice cream when I was a kid that I hated because the black walnuts tasted like onions.
And I didn't think they tasted like onions. I always thought they were kind of, and not that I ever ate poop, but for some reason I just felt they were very poopy.
I
swear I never ate poop. I really didn't.
And, you know, onion ice cream is nothing you want.
No, not that either. It's true. Anything with not necessarily walnuts. I don't like anything like big, humongous nuts, like the size of peach pits floating around in ice cream. I don't want that. I like that sort of like let it sort of flow into your. And yeah, there can be chunks of pineapple.
Yeah, I don't like a lot of business.
Yeah,
in
I like
my
that
ice
sort
cream.
Of flowing slowly down your gullet feeling. I don't like that I have to work. My jaw. When I'm eating ice cream, I'm lazy.
I'm not chewing.
Yeah, chewing is, yeah, that's too much work. I want somebody, if I'm going to have one with a lot of big nut, I want somebody to kind of manually maneuver my jaw. I want my wife standing next to me, shoving my jaw up and down like this.
another question?
Another number. Give me a number between 1 and 19.
11.
11. This one goes to 11. This is one that they always do on that. You ever watch that actor's show? What is it? Inside the Actors Factory?
Oh, yes. James Lipton. Yeah.
Yeah, and he always asks this one, and it's the stupidest damn question, so I had to put it on this one. What is your favorite curse word? Your favorite. Like, I guess by favorite, I get like what it, yeah, I don't know. What, it depends how you define favorite, but go ahead.
Yeah, most used is obviously the F word. But
well, can we say that on this show, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, we can. But I've been trying to back off just a little bit because you know Mrs. Fisher.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of Yeah, I get it.
But
I don't like to hear it a lot either, frankly.
At the end, the one I use and I like it just feels it's bastards.
Wow. There's something very noble about that. There's something like you should take out white gloves and slap somebody in the face after you've said that.
From the movie Office Space, there's one that has I've always thought was just terribly evocative, but I don't use it because but there's just this one moment when the protagonist in Office Space finds out something particularly odious, just vile corporate has happened, and he simply bursts out, cock gobblers.
Mm.
But, you know, bastards. Bastards.
Bastards is good. Mine is still, and I'm going to say it, because you just got to say it, it's fuck. Because it's a very versatile curse word.
Oh, it can be any part of speech in the English language.
It's a verb, obviously. You know, but it's also an interjection which shows excitement or emotion. Hallelujah, and there's just something about, and you add mother to it, you know, and you, if you want to sound a little more,
and it's it's explosive.
Yeah, it just has a it ends in a what is that? Not a fricative. You tell me, English major. The hard K.
Yeah, no. But,
yeah,
not
it,
now.
It starts out, and you're so it's like air. And then you got a drum kind of percussive sound to it. So I admire it, and I just go there. That's the adjective and so forth. I'm going to ask one more side question before we get to our quiz, because we're almost out of time on the trivia, and we got to go to the bonus quiz round. When was the first time you heard your parents curse, and do you remember what they said?
It had to be my dad. And I can't put an age on it. And it was definitely shit.
What about your mom? Isn't it always funny when you hear your mom curse?
My mother did, and it was damn.
Yeah, I mean, I was shocked. My mom, I know my mom never cursed in front of me. I can't remember specifics, but I'm sure my dad would. But neither of my parents were big cussers, as they would say in West Virginia. They didn't cuss. I think they both felt it was somehow demeaning. You know, that it made you look less.
Yeah, and my father despised the F word.
But my dad also. But my dad would enjoy a good dirty joke now and then. You know.
Oh no, no, my dad's two favorite jokes were the ones the punchline on one is wrecked him, damn near killed him, and the other punchline is rat, great big goddamn rat with a dick this big.
See, my mom would do. And I didn't hear it till my teen years. She would do what I call mom cursing or mom cussing, where it just comes out kind of cute. Like my dad did shift work. So a lot of times when we would get the Christmas tree, he wouldn't be there for that because he'd be at work. And so we'd bring the tree home and we're trying to get it in the stand. It's like one grown woman with three children of various degrees of skills and enthusiasm. trying to put up a Christmas tree with those little screws at the bottom, you know, the big long screws that you try to get to match the same way as the tree will get. And I just remember, like, the whole time, like, my mom underneath the tree, and I'm trying to hold it straight, and she's just going, shit, shit, shit. It's like she didn't want to use the I. She didn't want – it just was like S-H-T. And it was so cute, you know. But it was shocking at the time. But now that I think of it, it's cute. But at the time, it's like, oh, Mom, you know.
Meanwhile, Mrs. Fisher is sitting there at home thinking, I didn't realize he was hearing that.
Well, you know what's funny, too? I've gotten to the point, I've been on this show how many times? 8 or something like that? And I've been on enough times. That, like, the first couple of times I was on, it's like, hey, I'm doing Bob's podcast. Like, oh, great. And they'd, like, listen to it. And they'd, oh, I heard your podcast, and I wish you hadn't said that, or I really like that. But now it's sort of like, oh, I'm on the podcast. Oh, that's great.
Wow, that's not you. That's me.
It's like the first, you know, the first couple of movies I did. I did like this stupid after-school special. And like my dad watched it just because my name was at the end of it. And he was like, I didn't really think the Globetrotters put in that good a performance. Well, no, they didn't. They're the Globetrotters. They're not actors. He literally said this to me one time. But then after a while, it's like, hey, I did this movie that got nominated for Best Picture. Oh, you know, we're going to see it when it comes on TV. You know? So that's sort of where I'm at with the podcast now. So I don't know if any of my friends or family are actually listening to this.
You know, for years and years and years and years, there was a TV station in Northwest Alabama that still signed off at midnight. It was an independent, little bit of nothing. And long after I had left the Shoals, gone to CNN, and moved on from there to law school, every now and then my mom or my dad would mention, you know, they're still running your sign off audio when they sign off it. And so for, you know, WTRT now signs off another broadcast day, and apparently they just kept using it, and it went on for years and years and years.
And you signed one of those contracts that gave you like $200 for them to use it in
contract schmontract. I didn't get paid a damn dime.
Oh man.
No, it was Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, and let's have a TV station in our in my grandpa's barn, you know.
Somebody made a little money off it, and here's a hint, it wasn't you.
Bingo.
We've got 4 minutes left now. We can go a little over.
Yeah,
right?
We can. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to give – we talked about the Constitution, and the last time I was on here, I gave you a quiz about who's on currency, and you did extraordinarily well. I think you got every single one of them. Maybe the $500 one gave you a little trip up. I think that's that was McKinley, I think, is on the $500.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to ask you Constitution. I just went to one of those stupid quiz. Do you really know the U.S. Constitution? I'm online right now.
I'm so nervous.
Okay, let's see how you do, because, I mean, I'm sure there are people out there that just want you to fail. Let's see how you do. I bet you do pretty well. Okay, question one. Patrick Henry turned down an invitation to the Constitutional Convention because A, he was in ill health, B, he didn't trust it, or C, he was going to be in France at that time.
He didn't trust it.
That's what I guessed, and let's see if it's right. It's right. He didn't trust it.
Yep.
Correct answer. Patrick Henry, a leading figure in the American Revolution, decided not to be a delegate because, as he later revealed, he smelt a rat. Okay, I'm not going to explain too many of these because I want to get through questions. Here's the next one. How many words make up the main body of the Constitution? Is it A, 4,400, B, 450, or C, 16,010?
Oh, 4,450.
Well, it's either 4,400 or 450.
Oh, 4,400.
That's what I'm going to go for, the medium selection. I have no idea. Let's see if we're right or wrong. We're both going to agree on that one. Mm-hmm. Are we right? Yes, we're right. 4,400 words are in the Constitution. Okay, next question. Which national holiday? You're 2 for 2. Which national, and so am I, which national holiday did George Washington proclaim should honor the success of the Constitution? Is it Christmas? And this is what George Washington proclaimed. Is it Christmas, Constitution Day, or Thanksgiving?
Constitution Day.
I'm going to go off the rails on this one. Am I? Or should I just agree with you? I'm going to go crazy just because, so I don't keep agreeing with you. You're going to go Constitution Day. I'm going to say Thanksgiving Day, because I do remember that at one point Ben Franklin had recommended that the turkey be considered the national bird. And that's the only reason I'm choosing Thanksgiving. Plus, I want to be contrary. So let me see if I'm right first. Probably not. I'm right! I'm right, and you are wrong.
Oh,
Thanksgiving.
Oh. I can explain myself because Lincoln made the first official Thanksgiving proclamation.
Okay. Well, this is what it says here. President George Washington proclaimed Thanksgiving Day a national holiday during which the people should give thanks to God for the new Constitution. So it was just sort of enveloping it in the thing.
But it didn't stick.
It did not stick. It became about football and gluttony.
No, I mean, it didn't stick. It was just forgotten. And Thanksgiving only becomes a thing under Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War.
And when television came to be a thing. Constitutional Convention was convened in which season? Was it convened in winter, summer, or spring? Constitutional Convention.
Oh, Dr. Bill, where are you when I need you? Summer.
You have an answer.
Summer.
I'm going to go with summer as well. We're both right. So far, I'm 4-for-4. You're 3-for-4.
You have to take the travel needs of a 19th century stagecoach and horse culture.
Maybe it was from that musical 1776, or maybe it was from, I don't know, some Broadway musical, Hamilton, where something about like being hot and stuffy and sweaty. I don't know. Somebody was singing and dancing.
Yeah, that's 1776, and that's about the Declaration of Independence.
I don't know. Somebody was singing and dancing, and suddenly we got a constitution. That's all I really know about it. But yet somehow or other, I am one ahead of you. Just pure blind luck. Which of the founding fathers did not sign the Constitution? Was it the Constitution, mind you, not the Declaration? Was it George Washington and John Adams? John Adams and Thomas Jefferson? Or Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson?
Did not sign?
Did not sign the Constitution.
Adams and Jefferson.
Should I go contrary?
The other possible is Hamilton and Jefferson. Jefferson didn't sign because he wasn't part of the Constitutional Convention. But I assume that Hamilton was part of the New York delegation.
You're like the guy in the Jeopardy audience who's kind of giving out the answer. So I'm going to go contrary to you. You said Adams and Jefferson. I'm going to go Hamilton and Jefferson. Thanks to your help and the fact that I want to disagree with you. So let me see if you're right this time. You are right, and I am wrong. So you have 4 out of 5. I've got 4 out of 5. We're both tied. Again.
That was very genteel of you.
Well, I do know what that means. The framer of the Constitution met with the original purpose of A, revising the Articles of Confederation. The framers of the Constitution met with the original purpose of A, revising the Articles of Confederation, B, debating the role of slavery in the new country, or C, creating a new U.S. Constitution. What was the original purpose of the framers?
That's a trick question, kind of, because Madison knew what he was doing. And so they went in with the ostensible goal of revising the Articles of Confederation. But the Articles of Confederation didn't last any time at all before they had chucked it all and said, we're really here to do a constitution. So you could argue, there's two answers you could argue, but ostensibly it was to revise the Articles of Confederation.
Okay, so you know what? It's 9:03, so I'm going to make this our final question, and because you explained all that, so your answer is creating a new constitution, and that there could be two answers.
That's no, my answer is to revise the Articles of Confederation.
Okay, well, that's what my gut tells me. I thought you were going to say you were creating a new U.S. Constitution. I'm going to go opposite of you no matter what, because I don't want to end in a tie. I think you're probably right, and I'm going to click that, but I'm going to answer for myself creating a new U.S. Constitution, just to make this interesting. This is radio, after all. So let's see if you're right. Is it revising the Articles of Confederation? Yes, it is. And Dan Fisher is wrong. He put all his money on the final Jeopardy, so he goes home destitute.
Well, no. There's always that year's supply of Rice-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat, and the home version.
of How to Be a Liberal.
Exactly.
Or is that, Who wants to be a liberal? That's what I was going for. Anyway, it's 9:04 on your dial.
Well, that was,
Little Orphan Annie is coming up next.
And that was fun, and there's still several questions left, right?
Oh yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so we can work those. Don't lose those.
Put those in.
Don't lose those.
Well, God knows there's enough quizzes on the internet that I could. But this was a good one. This, for one thing, this didn't make me continually click to the next question and endure all the new ads and stuff like that. This was a good one. This was from HowStuffWorks.com. So yes, I'll keep that in mind for the next time around. And plus, I'll ask you more personal questions about yourself. See, part of my goal with this is not just to make entertaining radio, but I do wonder what people know about you, Bob Kincaid, beyond your political convictions. Like, they probably did not know that what your favorite flavor of ice cream was. Or maybe they did if they saw your Facebook post recently. The orange pineapple from, what's it called, Tamales?
No, Trowbridge's.
Trowbridge's.
Open since 1918.
Well, the best ice cream places are.
And you can also get there the world's best grilled peanut butter and banana sandwich.
Did Elvis actually ever go there? Because one would think.
Well, he's not. He is from not far from there.
It'd be things like, this was the one that killed him.
and had family over in that area.
Yeah, well, sure.
Part of the rich musical tradition of that little Brigadoonish corner of Northwest Alabama.
Brigadoon, another fine musical. Anyway, it's probably time for me to head off to Pills in Bed. That sounds like an Elvis Costello song. Pills, this is me next number.
Pills
in
Bed.
Yeah. It's angry like all of my songs are.
Or it could have been a later Clash tune.
Pills in Bed. If it were Prince, it'd be something else in bed. I don't know. But anyway, it is 9:06 now. Indeed. And the weather's coming up.
And here's Fred in the traffic copter. Dan, have yourself a wonderful evening.
And have yourself a merry little Christmas. I'll talk to you maybe the 13th?
Yeah.
Why don't I go back to the end of the month thing? Can I come back in 2 weeks? Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
Let's do it in 2 weeks.
Okay, groovy.
Okay, later.
Later.
Love
you, man. And that is the one and only Dan Fisher. I enjoy our conversation so much because we can do some politics stuff and then we can do some silly stuff. And yes, that orange pineapple ice cream is without peer. Thank you to Ralphs for jumping in on the fundraising. We find ourselves $15 short of meeting Chris's challenge within a challenge, to the anonymous Have a Show on Me challenge. So hopefully, maybe there's $15 out there and we can meet Chris's challenge, and I can tell her later this evening when sunrise happens in Deutschland. Lady B points out back to the cursing. Keanu Reeves in the movie Point Break. That was the first time I heard someone use the term "fuck me." Yeah, that's a good one too. Or from Here in the Hills, "fuck me running." We say it that way. My second favorite, Lady B notes, is of course "motherfucker." You got to say it just like that, "motherfucker." And you can use it in anger or disbelief. "Motherfucker" or "motherfucker." And of course, the latter is the official Richard Pryor pronunciation. "Motherfucker." Very versatile and powerful word. I agree entirely. So thanks, everybody, for joining in for this ongoing little conversation. I enjoyed it immensely. I hope you did as well. And we'll get back together tomorrow for Friday on the Front Porch. Tomorrow's one of those take Ferg to work and bring Ferg home from work days. I hope I don't have to have a delayed start to the program, but if we do, we do. And I'll put up some sort of notice, and we'll take it from there. Okie doke. Thanks. And thanks to all of you who keep the program on the air. Thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in this conversation, however you so choose to do. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Steve from Georgia Stan and Sparky in the chat room this evening. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 years this year, the 20th anniversary of Coal River Mountain Watch, standing at the forefront in the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.